Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and we're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast, 48 degrees, and clear, Sirius rising in the east. This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to discover more about why we are here, where we came from, and what we might become than you thought possible. Look out the window, recline your chair, because we are about ready to start another hour of X Squared Radio. Tonight we have Michael Barra coming on the program at 6 p.m. in our second hour, so you need to hang out for that. He has a new book out called Ancient Aliens on the Moon. We were together last weekend on a 2012 panel hosted by George Norrie. I invited him on the program and he accepted, and we're so glad because he's going to be here tonight at 6. Earth's magnetic field is unsettled tonight following a lengthy G1 class geomagnetic storm yesterday. While the storm of yesterday subsides, another may be in the offing. NOAA forecasters estimate a 55% chance of polar geomagnetic storms today and tomorrow in response to an incoming solar wind stream. High latitude sky watchers should remain alert for auroras tonight. The solar wind is 495 kilometers per second, and the proton count is down to 0.1 per cubic centimeter. There are five giant sunspots on the Earth. An active one is located just over the sun's northeastern limb, and it exploded early this morning. The eruption hurled a coronal mass ejection into space. There's a Soho movie on it out there. The cloud will not affect Earth because our planet was not in the line of fire. Future eruptions, however, might be geo-effective. The sun's rotation is about to bring that sunspot onto Earth's side, where we could become the targets for future flares. Jupiter's radio storms, by the way, have caused natural radio lasers in the planet's magnetosphere that sweep past the Earth as Jupiter rotates. Electrical currents flowing between Jupiter's upper atmosphere and the volcanic moon Io can boost these emissions to power levels easily detectable by ham radio antennas on Earth. Jovian S bursts and L bursts actually mimic the sounds of woodpeckers, whales, and waves crashing on the beach. You can go to spaceweather.com and actually listen to a few clips of that. It's kind of fascinating to listen to. In preparation for the close of this year, I want to make sure that you select some good Christmas presents for your family and your friends and yourself. You should always buy yourself a Christmas present, by the way. You too. Love yourself, don't you? Of course. I can suggest three really good things to buy for yourself. Number one, you should always have a little bit of food storage on hand. And by a little bit, I think that depends on your budget and how much you think you should take care of yourself or whether you think you should rely on FEMA or some other family member. But you know I'm going to recommend this because our great affiliates, The Food Investor, one of the best investments you can make, because you can't eat those coins. And money, although it's conveniently called salad, is not edible, but food is, and food will keep you alive. And food will let you let that FEMA truck go on by so nobody knows you're prepared. You don't have to leave your premises and go to a camp or a tent or some other kind of relocation. You can take care of yourself. How do you do that? Well, you go to xsquaredradio.com and you click on the banner at the top of the website X Squared Radio called The Food Investor. My good friends out in Utah have created this amazing company, Scott Barzee, Danny Morris. They're not only great cooks, but they figured out how to preserve food for 30 years without preservatives. That's important. This is delicious stuff. It's not that pasty stuff you get in the MRE. No, no, no. This is a really delicious meal. I've tried it. I like it. You can go click on that banner at X Squared Radio, and you can take care of yourself in style. You don't have to choke it down your neck in order to survive for the next day. I recommend at least a 72-hour kit, just enough to get you by for 3 days in case the power goes out in the middle of this next winter, which it may, because you know our summers are getting nasty and our winters are getting even nastier. But if you really feel compelled, and I suggest that you consider it, 2 weeks, a month, maybe 2 months supply for you, your family, and maybe your neighbors, so they don't try to come over and take your stuff. The Food Investor, check it out. The second thing that you should buy for yourself and for your family is silver. Yes, silver. Do I make any money on this? No, I don't. I don't even have a link for it on my website. But I'm going to give you one that you can go to where you can actually get the silver in your hands at a great price. Everybody who knows the business knows Engelhard makes the best, highest quality silver bars in the world. It's a trusted name around the world. Everywhere where you buy silver, that name is recognized. Well, let me tell you how to get the silver quick, cheap, just a few dollars over spot, and convenient. APMEX, APMEX.com. Go there. Select the silver bars, which they have all kinds. They have silver coins, they have silver ingots, all kinds. But I recommend the little 1 ounce bars because they're convenient. And if you should have to pay for something, you can shell out a couple bars without having to throw a big 100 ounce brick up on the table. Do that. APMEX.com. Get some silver in your hands. Oh, right now it's selling for about $38 an ounce, and it should be selling for about $380 an ounce. If you want to, I'll send you a video so that you can watch and learn about why silver is so undervalued right now. Gold, that's a little out of reach for most people. Come on, $1,800, $1,900 an ounce, let's get serious. That's for the rich and famous. Silver, that's for you and me. $38 an ounce, and it should go up 10 times if it adjusts correctly. Right now it's being shorted terribly by J.P. Morgan Stanley. But as you know, if you follow this program, Russia and China are pressing very hard because they own a lot of that silver. Bullion, not the metal. That means that they're going to want delivery of the metal pretty soon. Well, there's one small problem. J.P. Morgan Stanley doesn't have the metal. They have to go buy it in order to deliver it. And when that happens, the price is going to go through the roof. You might as well be on the right side of that wave, people. So do that. The third thing I recommend is a great book, either an audio, on Kindle, on Nook, or in print. And you can do that by going to xsquaredradio.com, clicking on any of the fine books that are for sale there. My good friend Hallie has a book there, and Phoenix Rising, and you can also pick any of the Ark of Millions of Years series or the Quad, or you can fit select Alienated Nation or Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. These are things that really make a good gift for people. Hey, I saw a couple of movies this weekend. I wanted to do a couple of quick movie reviews. I know you probably don't have this on the top of your list, but I highly recommend it because I saw the quality of this in the trailer and I like the people that are in it. Here Comes the Boom. Oh yeah. Here Comes the Boom. Not only was the theater pretty well packed, but it was a very good movie. The acting was great. The directing was great. The music was great. The music was phenomenal. And it's a really good feel-good movie. And you could take your kids to it, too. It's a good movie. You'll enjoy it. The second movie I watched was Atlas Shrugged. Now, you know, the message was an adaptation of Ayn Rand's novel of the same name. That's an old novel. But the government has drawn its battle lines in this movie between them and the capitalist free enterprise system. Now, it's just a movie, right? Well, perhaps not. It is clear that the successful are being targeted for liquidation by the current administration. We hope that the new one is not the same. Did I mention that my prediction is Romney by 48 states? Oh, yes. If you're not up to speed, make sure you follow me on Twitter, at Brooks Agnew. I think only Hawaii and D.C. will go for Obama. There is a peculiar smell when the fire has gone out of the belly of a presidential candidate. Tonight at 6 p.m., we have the indomitable Mike Barra coming on X Squared Radio. He's the author of the new book, Ancient Aliens on the Moon. Oh, yeah, you thought you knew the moon was hollow or the moon was special or there were aliens on the moon. Well, you ain't heard nothing yet. Mike Barra is coming on at 6. Also in the news, probably one of the most amazing things that I've seen in quite a while. I always like to think about people doing great things. I like to do great things. You should aspire to do great things. This man has been doing great things his whole life. And he's not just a thrill seeker. I mean, not just the kind of guy that jumps on a motorcycle and leaps over 59 buses, you know, at a dirt track race. No. This guy is the highest tech of great things. Felix Baumgartner. Extreme athlete Felix Baumgartner landed gracefully on Earth after a 24-mile jump from the stratosphere in a dramatic, record-breaking feat that may also have marked the world's first supersonic skydive. The jury's still out. They're checking his speed. I'm going to play a couple of audio clips for you so you can experience what he really went through. Mr. Baumgartner came down safely in the eastern New Mexico desert minutes, about 9 minutes after jumping from his capsule, 128,097 feet, or roughly 24 miles above the earth. He lifted his arms in victory, saluted, sending off loud cheers from jubilant onlookers because they filmed the entire thing live from the capsule, and friends inside the mission's control center in Roswell, New Mexico. Sometimes we have to get really high to see how small we are, an exuberant Baumgartner told reporters outside mission control shortly after the jump. He was expected to offer more remarks at an afternoon news conference, which he did. The altitude he leapt from marked the highest ever for a skydiver, though it wasn't immediately certain whether Baumgartner had broken the speed of sound during his free fall, which was one of the goals of the mission. Organizers said the descent lasted for just over 9 minutes, about half of it in free fall. Yow! 3 hours earlier, Baumgartner, known as Fearless Felix, had taken off in a pressurized capsule carried by a 55-story, ultra-thin helium balloon. After an at-times tense ascent, which included concern about how well his facial shield was working, the 43-year-old former military parachutist completed a final safety checklist with Mission Control. You'll hear that latter part of the countdown when I play you the audio. As he exited his capsule from high above the earth, he flashed a thumbs up, well aware the feat was being shown on a live stream on the internet, saluted with his right hand. During the ensuing jump from more than three times the height of the average cruising altitude for jetliners, Baumgartner was expected to hit a speed of 690 miles per hour. He was believed to have reached speeds that exceeded 700 miles per hour. Any contact with the capsule on his exit could have torn his pressurized suit, a rip that could have exposed him to a lack of oxygen and temperatures as low as minus 70 degrees. That could have caused lethal bubbles to form in his bodily fluids. But none of that happened. He activated his chute as he neared Earth, gently gliding into the desert east of Roswell, New Mexico, and landing without any apparent difficulty. The images triggered another loud cheer from onlookers at Mission Control, among them his mom, Ava Baumgartner, who was overcome with emotion, crying. I'm going to play for you now the first jump, which was a preparatory jump, which he did earlier. This is the audio from it. Listen closely. Here we go.
This is a man who just minutes ago was going 536 miles an hour in free fall with nothing but a flight suit.
Well, it feels great.
Skydiver Felix Baumgartner, after surviving a jump from nearly 18 miles, that's 96,000 feet, over the New Mexico desert. It's his final test before attempting a record-breaking 120,000 feet and trying to break the sound barrier on his way down.
The sky was totally black. You know, I could see the curvature of the earth, so it was amazing today.
But in the extreme cold and near vacuum, where a drop of water would vaporize instantly, any puncture of the suit or a malfunction of his life support system would mean instant death. Boarding his capsule at dawn, Baumgartner was launched with the help of a crane. Then an hour and a half trip up with his helium balloon to a height about three times your average jetliner cruising altitude.
You have to be focused, otherwise you're going to die.
Then the critical jump.
It feels totally different, you know. You have absolutely no control when you exit. So it turned me around a couple of times because there's no supportive air. So there's no way to get off stable. That was the big learning from this one.
Then the free fall, just 3 minutes, 48 seconds, followed by 7 minutes with a parachute. His life depended on not getting caught in a spin and on his chute deploying successfully.
And Felix has landed safely back to Earth.
One of his advisors, retired Captain Joe Kittinger, who set the record in 1960.
Now there's only two of us that jumped that high.
Kittinger jumped from a little higher, nearly 102,000 feet, a daring jump, in spite of an alarming suit malfunction that caused one of his hands to swell up. Baumgartner has done thousands of jumps from planes, skyscrapers, cliffs, even the giant statue in Rio. His next jump, if he breaks the sound barrier, would be over 700 miles an hour.
Nobody can tell you what happens to the human body if you break or travel at the speed of sound. And this is, until the very end, still the biggest unknown.
If he succeeds, he would be the first person to go Mach 1 with no plane, no vehicle, no equipment, nothing but his body and a flight suit. Lisa Sylvester.
All right, so that was the preliminary jump. That was the one that just got him started. Now I'm going to play you the actual soundtrack from the jump today, from the time that the capsule lifted off. There, we edited out quite a few pieces so that we could get it inside this show or this program tonight. But you're going to hear his actual audio because, you know, it's very difficult to broadcast when you're going 700 miles an hour straight down. But, you know, listen closely. I think you'll enjoy it. This is history in the making. Here we go.
Beginning to be inflated.
Now, here we go. There's the bubble rising. There's the tail going out. The crane will move forward. So far, we've got a good start. It's good so far. Beautiful shot there. There's the release, and there's the applause, a successful rise.
And they're going up just great.
So 60 degrees inside the capsule.
But look, outside the capsule, it's already dropped down to 35 degrees.
Attention on that. This is Mission Control. We currently show the Stratos capsule with Felix is ascending. He is at 11,600 feet.
And there's a bit wider shot there. You see where he has his checklists posted.
Felix, we're only at 100,000 feet. You still got 28,000 feet to go.
Put the dump valve all the way to the rear. Put the dump valve all the way to the rear.
The door is opening now.
Item 32, verify cutaway knife handle strap is attached and knife in proper position. Felix, disconnect the oxygen hose. Atta boy. All right, stand up on the exterior step. Keep your head down. Release the helmet tie-down strap. Start the cameras. And our guardian angel will take care of you.
Paul, you are not going over.
Jump away.
He is speed falling like a bullet out of that craft.
Speed 725.
Well, that's very, very reassuring what we've seen there.
We reached 729 miles an hour.
High speed drop, and now you can see from the little dot, where's the cloud?
Still three miles. You're really stable, and you fall in 3.5 minutes.
They had a camera on him, and he was spinning.
There's the chute.
He got into air. And then he stabilized his fall like a true professional.
There he is. There's a closer shot from the helicopter.
Wind's out of the east, Felix. Wind's out of the east.
By pulling the cords, he can control a fair amount of control on his path into this landing. Now we see that scrub earth below. So he certainly got the highest jump mark that he was after. We'll find out about the Mach. Did he break the speed of sound as he hoped? Here he's coming. And there you can see by the approaching shadow, he's just about there, and he's down here.
He landed standing up.
We have unofficial word there on some of those statistics.
Well, there you have it. Felix, fearless Felix Baumgartner, jumping from 24 miles up, exactly 128,097 feet. That is a record that it's going to stand for a long time. He fell 729 miles an hour, but did not break the record for the longest jump. I guess when you're falling faster, it takes less time. And he landed on his feet. He then was taken by helicopter to meet fellow members of his team, who he hugged in celebration. Coincidentally, Baumgartner's attempted feat also marked the 65th anniversary of the U.S. test pilot Chuck Yeager's successful attempt to become the first man to officially break the sound barrier aboard an airplane. At Baumgartner's insistence, some 30 cameras recorded the event Sunday, shortly after launch. Screens at Mission Control showed the capsule as it began rising high above the New Mexico desert, with cheers erupting from organizers. Red Bull is one of the major sponsors of the event. Very, very intelligent, smart man putting this venture together. Baumgartner's team included Joe Kittinger, who was the first to attempt the sound barrier from 19.5 miles up in 1960, and he reached speeds of 614 miles per hour. With Kittinger inside Mission Control Sunday, that's the person you heard speaking in the background by microphone, the two men could be heard going over technical details during the ascension. He said, if you didn't hear it clearly, "Our guardian angel will take care of you." An hour into the flight, Baumgartner had ascended to more than 63,000 feet. ballast was dropped to speed up the ascent. Kittinger told him, "Everything is in the green. You're doing great." As Baumgartner ascended in the balloon, so did the number of viewers watching on YouTube. Nearly 7.3 million watched live as he sat on the edge of the capsule moments before jumping. After he landed, Red Bull posted a picture of Baumgartner on his knees on the ground to Facebook, generating nearly 216,000 likes, 10,000 comments, and more than 29,000 shares in less than 40 minutes. On Twitter, half the worldwide trending topics had something to do with the jump, pushing past seven NFL football games. Among the tweets was one from NASA. "Congratulations to Felix Baumgartner and the Red Bull Stratus on record-breaking leap from the edge of space. This attempt marked the end of a five-year road for Baumgartner, a record-setting high-altitude jumper. He already made two preparation jumps in the area, one from 15 miles and another from 18 miles, which we played for you earlier. It will also be the end of his extreme altitude jumping career. He has promised this will be his final jump." Baumgartner has said he plans to settle down with his girlfriend and safely fly helicopters on mountain rescue and firefighting missions in the U.S. and Austria. Well, I can think of a few safer things to do. I hope maybe we can break this 7.3 million record on YouTube with the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition when we go live. Also in the news, just thought I should let you know that Muslim homicide bombers are actually on strike. That's true. You know, it's a profession just like anything else. Muslim suicide bombers in Britain are set to begin a three-day strike on Monday in a dispute over the number of virgins they are entitled to in the afterlife. The emergency talks with Al-Qaeda have so far failed to produce an agreement. The unrest began last Tuesday when Al-Qaeda announced that the number of virgins a suicide bomber would receive after his death would be cut by 25% this February, from 72 to 54. A spokesman said increases in recent years and the number of suicide bombings has resulted in a shortage of virgins in the afterlife. The Suicide Bombers Union, the British Organization of Occupational Martyrs, or BOOM, responded with a statement saying the movie was unacceptable to its members and called for a strike vote. I'm sorry, the move was unacceptable to its members and called for a strike vote. General Secretary Abdullah Amir told the press, "Our members are literally working themselves to death in the cause of jihad. We don't ask for much in return, but to be treated like this is a kick in the teeth." Speaking from his shed in Tipton in the West Midlands, Al-Qaeda chief executive Haishit Maipants explained, "I sympathize with our workers' concerns, but Al-Qaeda is simply not in a position to meet their demands. They are simply not accepting the realities of modern-day jihad in a competitive marketplace. Thanks to Western depravity, there is now a chronic shortage of virgins in the afterlife. It's a straight choice between reducing expenditures or laying people off. I don't like cutting benefits, but I hate to have to tell 3,000 of my staff that they won't be able to blow themselves up. Now, come on." Spokespersons for the union in the northeast of England, Ireland, Wales, and the entire Australian continent stated that the change would not hurt their membership, as there are so few virgins in their areas anyway. According to some industry sources, the recent drop in the number of suicide bombings has been attributed to the emergence of actress Rosie O'Donnell. It's true. Many Muslim jihadists now know what a virgin looks like and have reconsidered their benefit packages. In a related story, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta is warning that America could face cyber attacks capable of derailing passenger trains and allowing attackers to contaminate large water systems. They're watching closely. They want to make sure that everything's safe. The Department of Homeland Security is on top of everything. By the way, I also want to let you know in 30 minutes, Mike Barra is coming on the program tonight. He's the author of Ancient Aliens on the Moon. We spent some time together this last weekend serving on a 2012 conference hosted by George Norrie. And Mike and I reached an agreement that he'll come on tonight and tell us about his book. He's feeling a little under the weather, but we'll be happy to listen to his stories and his insights on ancient aliens on the moon. So don't go away. About 28 minutes, he's going to be coming on. Anyway, speaking to the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum in New York on October 11th, just a few days ago, Panetta said individuals in adversarial nations like China, Russia, and Iran could use cyber tools to gain control of critical switches. He said such attackers could derail passenger trains, or even more dangerous, they could derail passenger trains loaded with lethal chemicals. They could also contaminate the water supply in major cities or shut down the power grid across large parts of the country. Critics allege that Panetta is trying to scare Republicans into supporting the cyber security bill Senator John McCain and others blocked in August. Many of you wrote this program and also posted your fears on Facebook that the government was trying to seize control of the internet and literally monitor everything everyone was doing. The opposition to that bill arose from concerns that passage of the bill would mean more burdensome and costly new regulations for American businesses, and that's true as well. Panetta is countering critics by warning that the U.S. could face a cyber Pearl Harbor if something isn't done. The next article is another support for my advice to you that you make sure to keep the majority of your money in cash or precious metals that you hold in your possession. Of course, you know that I recommend silver. And if you're just tuning into this program, I make no money on this, no commission whatsoever. Don't even have a link to their website on my website. But I buy my silver from APMEX, APMEX. It's the cheapest place to buy silver that I have found. And I'm not talking about bullion. You're not going to own a little certificate or hold it in your 401k account. You will have the physical silver in your hands. So you can put it with yourself in your own safe or your own box or your own photo album in the bookshelf, however you want to store it. And that silver could get you out of a heck of a mess if things go south. If you have drafts set up for internet service, insurance, and other stuff, make sure you keep enough in your account to cover those obligations. But my advice to you is keep all your disposable income in cash at home. I do not recommend holding anything larger than 20s. You will have to have exact change when you're shopping because most places will not have cash. It will be rare. Most people, as you know, are out there with debit cards. Worthless. You want to see things fall apart and fall apart fast? You pull the plug on food stamp cards and watch how fast that happens. Here's another reason why this is important. An Islamist group on Tuesday of this last week said it will carry out new cyber attacks on U.S. banking targets. According to Site Intelligence Group, the following similar attacks last week, allegedly in response to an anti-Islam film, I say allegedly, actually this is a planned attack that any cowardly anarchist would utilize to tear down society. There is no intent to build up or create, only to destroy. The mainstream press is participating in the Islamic misinformation campaign by keeping us focused on a false target, also known as anti-free speech tactic. Those of you that watch certain news programs or mainstream outlets know nothing about this, absolutely nothing. All you know is the part the party line, and I feel sorry for you. But if you're listening to this program, at least you know this small amount. In a statement, a group of hackers calling themselves the Cyber Fighters of Izz al-Din al-Qassam said they planned to attack the website of Wells Fargo Bank on Tuesday, that of U.S. Bank on Wednesday, and the PNC Bank on Thursday. Wednesday, Wells Fargo portals were brought to a near standstill across the web. Millions of depositors were denied speedy access to their accounts online. Direct deposits were delayed, and thousands of man hours were spent trying to make sure accounts remained intact. Most of them were. The FBI is hunting them, click by click, through cyberspace to find the perpetrators. When the buck stops, the arrests will be made. Last week, the websites of U.S. Bank's Chase, a J.P. Morgan Chase affiliate, and Bank of America suffered a suspected cyber attack following threats against them by the same group. Operation Ababil began with Bank of America. The second stage was the attack on the biggest bank of the United States, Chase. This series of attacks will continue until this threat disappears from the internet. The truth is, it's all about the money. It has nothing to do with the film. Remember Hans Gruber in Die Hard 1? When the demand to free all the terror brothers held around the world distracted law enforcement while they stole the bearer bonds? Yeah, same thing here. Same thing. In the latest statement, the group claimed the attacks were in retaliation for the release of a controversial movie, which we all know, if you listen to this program and listen to other news outlets, is a bunch of Feldergarb. Feldergarb, it comes from the first issue of Battlestar Galactica, okay? Any person who would believe that junk reported needs to turn in their high school diploma for reconsideration. The statement warned that the operation might eventually target Israeli, French, and British financial institutions as well, according to Site. These attackers are learning how to pull off the biggest heist in history by doing this. If you think they are working alone or independently, you also need to turn in your high school diploma. Remember, the agency government is writing checks every single minute of the day that it cannot beat to the bank. Two things will happen. The Fed will print money to prevent the dollar from crashing, which it's doing right now at the tune of $40 to $80 billion a month, and the 401k accounts will be targeted for confiscation. If you want yours, you better cash it in now. Take the 10% hit and get the cash into your house. Or do the same thing John Corzine did to his account holders. That same thing will happen to you. Remember, the FDIC insurance does not cover accounts that are in the money market. If you have money market support to your checking or savings account with a minimum balance, none of that money is insured. If your 401k account is not insured, that account belongs to the company that you worked for or to the government until you roll it over into a self-directed IRA. If that money goes bankrupt or that company goes bankrupt, your 401k account is absorbed by the Board of Equalization. Trust me on this. The collapse will happen, and they're only looking for the right anti-Islamic video to blame it on. What could be better than repealing free speech, the Second Amendment, and grabbing your 401k account all in one presidency? Bingo. Any questions? Didn't think so. 19 minutes, Mike Barra is coming on. He's the author of Ancient Aliens on the Moon, I promise. A lively discussion about things you may have never considered before. That's what we're good at here. We go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with me, so you'll be fine. Miracles do happen. A Nebraska man in need of a heart transplant instead has a miracle recovery. Pharmacy student Michael Crow, he's 23, hardly the age of a man you'd think would have a heart condition, went to an Omaha hospital in August suffering from toxic blood poisoning, which led to acute myocarditis, or inflammation of the heart muscle. But after setbacks in his quest to get a heart transplant, his failing heart suddenly mended itself. It's true, a 23-year-old Nebraska man suffering from toxic blood poisoning. Doctors still don't have any medical answers as to how Michael Crow overcame a dangerous and untreatable viral infection that caused his heart to shut down. His family credits good medical work and prayer. Crow, a second-year student at the University of Nebraska Medical Center College of Pharmacy, was sent to an Omaha hospital in mid-August where he was diagnosed with acute myocarditis, or inflammation of the heart muscle. Crow's symptoms had started out like flu and quickly worsened. As Crow's heart shut down, his other organs were also starting to fail. He was on a full heart and lung machine and needed daily blood transfusions. It is just truly a miracle, his mother said, Margie Crow. Excellent medical care, and I think the power of prayer. Do you think maybe he would have got it in one of those blood transfusions, blood from somebody that might have had higher consciousness? You think he got supercharged blood? You think maybe that supercharged blood entered his system and knocked out that virus? I think it's possible, don't you? I would like to hear your opinion on it. If you've got a phone, you could go ahead and call in. It's 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. We've got time for a couple phone calls if you want to do it. By the way, the conference call line is open, 760-569-7676. And you dial the passcode 192-919-pound, and then you can listen to the program on your phone as you're running about. Or if you have a Droid phone, it's even easier. You can go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the Droid app on the left-hand side. You click on that, download it to your phone, and you are one click away from being, boom, right into X Squared Radio Live. I also want to send a shout-out to my friends at Truth Frequency Network. They're doing us a great service by rebroadcasting tonight's program. So we are live all over the world right now, not only through the BBS Radio Network, but also through the Truth Frequency Network. Thank you very much, Chris and Sherry. Again, my friend Mike Barra coming on at 6 p.m. Don't forget. And also don't forget the Food Investor. I have a couple more stories here. A Buddhist statue brought to Germany from Tibet by a Nazi-backed expedition has been confirmed as having extraterrestrial origin. Well, no, I mean, not the statue itself. I mean, it wasn't a statue when it came from outer space. Known as the Iron Man, the 24-centimeter-high sculpture may represent the god Vajravana, and was likely created, carved, from a piece of the Chinga meteorite that was strewn across the border region between Russia and Mongolia between 10,000 and 20,000 years ago, according to Elmar Buchner of the University of Stuttgart and his colleagues. In a paper published in Meteoritics and Planetary Science, the team reports their analysis of the iron, nickel, cobalt, and trace elements of a sample from the statue, as well as its structure. They found that the geochemistry of the artifact is a match for values known from fragments of the Chinga meteorite. The piece turned into the Iron Man would be the third largest known from that fall. Might have had some supernatural properties, too, being a meteorite. Given the extreme hardness of the meteorite, basically an inappropriate material for producing sculptures, the paper notes, The artist or artists who created it may have known their material was special. The researchers say Buchner suggests it could have been produced by the 11th century Ben culture, but the exact origin and age of the statue as opposed to the meteorite it is made from is still unknown. It is thought to have been brought to Germany by a Nazi-backed expedition to Tibet in 1938 or 1939. The swastika symbol on the piece, a version of which was adopted by the Nazi Party, may have encouraged the 1938 expedition to take it back with them. Look, it's got our sign on it. Actually, it's a symbol, a Tibetan symbol of the Milky Way galaxy. While the first debris was officially discovered in 1913 by gold prospectors, we believe that this individual meteorite fragment was collected many centuries before, said Buchner in a statement. The Iron Man statue is the only known illustration of a human figure to be carved from a meteorite. Although this item may be the only known human figure carved into a rock fallen to Earth, other meteorites have also been used by many religions across the world. A 15-ton example in North America called the Willamette meteorite is sacred to some Native Americans, while some have suggested that the black stone in the Kaaba in Mecca is a meteorite. One of the aspects of this may be the missed by first consideration of these icons that are made from extraterrestrial resources is that these were fully refined chunks of metal. Ancient civilizations did not have widespread displays of skills in mining and refining metal, so a chunk of refined metal falling out of the sky is a treasure to find because all the hard work is already done for you. That's the best analysis anyone can make. However, it's a little difficult to figure out how they actually carved the Buddha out of this ultra-hard piece of iron and nickel. What is the relation between selective attention and consciousness? Ha ha ha. Well, when you strain to listen to the distant baying of coyotes over the sound of a campsite conversation, you do so by attending to the sound and becoming conscious of their howls. When you attend to your sparring opponent out of the corner of your eye, you become hyper-aware of his smallest gestures. Because of the seemingly intimate relation between attention and consciousness, most scholars conflate the two processes. Indeed, when I came out of the closet to give public talks on the mind-blowing problem in the early 1990s, and at that time it wouldn't do for a young professor in biology or engineering who had not yet attained a holy state of tenure to talk about consciousness, it was considered too fringe. Some of my colleagues insisted that I replace the incendiary consciousness with the more neutral attention, because the two concepts could not be distinguished and were probably the same thing anyway. 2 decades later, a number of experiments proved that the two are definitely not the same. Yeah, but attention is a little more socially acceptable in the world of scientists to say consciousness, at least 10 years ago, wasn't really acceptable. Today, with the likes of Amit Goswami and Michio Kaku and Fred Allen Wolf and, you know, great minds like that, Kip Thorne talking about consciousness, perhaps it's a little more acceptable. We have some colleagues that we can lean back on. But in those days, it was a little wild-eyed, so to speak. Consciousness is one of those things that may precede quantum gravity. At least that's my contention with Sir Roger Penrose, who says that consciousness is the result of quantum gravity. I maintain quite the opposite. It's quantum gravity that's the result of consciousness. But, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Everyone knows that the egg could not get along for 1 hour without the chicken, one way or the other. Also in the news, I want to let you know it's okay to tell time. Lots of things are out there to tell time. You know, the Maya calendar is the only calendar made that's actually formed not from a religion. All other calendars on the earth are. And we've gotten better at telling time. We went from sundials to the Antikytherica device and then, you know, on to precision wound devices. That's how we began measuring the curvature of the earth and used it for navigation. But also we started using crystals to measure against because they oscillate at very high frequency and they're very consistent. And so we take that vibration frequency and we divide it all the way down to seconds. And even the division errors are so tiny that you only lose a couple of seconds a year. Well, now there's a space-time crystal. Scientists have proposed a way to build a clock that will keep perfect time forever. No, I mean after the universe is gone. The idea for an eternal clock that would continue to keep time even after the universe ceased to exist. What time is it now? Has intrigued physicists. However, no one has figured out how one might be built. Well, that is until now. Researchers have now proposed an experimental design for a space-time crystal that would be able to keep time forever. Yeah, so your girlfriend can tell exactly how late you are forever. That's right. This four-dimensional crystal would be similar to conventional 3D crystals, which are actually structures like snowflakes and diamonds, whose atoms are arranged in repeating patterns. Whereas a diamond has a periodic structure in three dimensions, the space-time crystal would be periodic in time as well as space. The idea of a 4D space-time crystal was first proposed earlier this year by MIT physicist Frank Wilczek. Though the concept was purely theoretical, now a team of researchers led by Zhang Zhang of California's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory has conceived of how to make one a reality. The idea of creating a crystal with dimensions higher than that of conventional 3D crystals is an important conceptual breakthrough in physics. And it is very exciting for us to be the first to devise a way to realize a space-time crystal. Well, the interesting thing about it is when the first accurate clocks were created, we were able to start navigating the curvature of Earth. We could then know how long you had to travel in one direction in order to make a precise turn, and that way you could triangulate your way and you could actually navigate the oceans based on a sextant and an accurate watch. Well, of course, because it doesn't do any good to tell somebody, okay, I'm under the moon now. No, you have to be able to travel in a certain distance for a certain amount of time. The more accurately you can measure that time, the more closely you can hit your distance targets. Well, that's in 3D. You think maybe we'll be able to navigate space better if we have a 4D clock? Pretty interesting, huh? Pretty interesting indeed. Hey, let's go ahead and take a 5-minute break while we get ready for Mike Barra to come on the program. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio after this.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned-up basement with the full moon in my eyes. was hoping for a replacement. When the sun burst through the sky, there was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Here with us this hour, we have Mike Barra, who is the incredible author, lecturer, been in several History Channel specials. He's everywhere. Mike Barra is a New York Times best-selling author and lecturer. He began his writing career after spending more than 25 years as an engineering consultant for major aerospace companies, where he was a card-carrying member of the military-industrial complex. A self-described born-again conspiracy theorist, Mike's first book, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, co-authored with the venerable Richard C. Hoagland, was a New York Times bestseller in 2007. He describes his new book, The Choice, published by New Page Books, as the unified field theory of physics and metaphysics. The Choice peels back the layers of mystery around the Maya calendar, 2012, and the future we can expect if we don't heed nature's warning signs. Mike has made numerous public appearances lecturing on the subjects of space science, NASA physics, and the link between science and spirit, and has been a featured guest on radio programs like X Squared Radio and Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. He is a regular contributor to the History Channel programs, Ancient Aliens, and America's Book of Secrets, both of which are now showing on the H2 channel. He has a new book out, Ancient Aliens on the Moon. I know, you thought you knew that we'd been to the moon, we had 12 sets of footprints up there, that we saw bases on the other side of the moon, we saw ships in the skies over the moon, that maybe even we saw ships on the horizon while the astronauts were there, and nobody would tell you a thing about it. But no one knew that there were ancient aliens on the moon and that there are actually ruins on the moon until now. Welcome to the program, Mike. What's up?
Hey, Brooks. Not a whole lot, except that I brought back some strange disease from the Conscious Life Expo last weekend, but I'm getting over that, and I hope you didn't catch it, whatever it was. You know, con crud, as they like to call it.
Nope, I'm immortal stuff, so none of that affects me.
Okay, so I'm doing really great. It's been a spectacularly interesting weekend so far. I think starting with the really amazing event that happened today, where what's his name, Felix Baumgartner jumped from 120,000 feet. Which, wow, does that take a pair or what?
Oh my gosh, I could just see you standing on the edge of that thing and say, okay, guys, can we just deflate this thing and I can pull like the big chute and come down in this capsule? Because this is really high.
Yeah, I changed my mind. I mean, I thought that was just an incredible feat of human courage. And, you know, granted, I mean, he had all kinds of technology and, he'd proven the technology out before with other jumps and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm sure it wasn't as deadly scary as it would be to most of us, but geez, it just takes, it's a real testament to me, to the human spirit, to challenge limits and push limits and do things that other people have never done. And I was just so enthusiastic watching that.
It's a long, silent ascent, you know. I could just imagine him listening to, "This is ground control to Major Tom." You know, it's like you got a long time to think about jumping out that door.
You do have a long time to think about it, and I just, you know, what an incredible experience it must have been. And, you know, even though it was such a short fall, really, it was a very short free fall. It was only 3 or 4 minutes, and still, I just think it's, you know, I have such admiration for somebody who has the guts to do that. And, you know, my brother, Dave Barra, has often talked about how, you know, when he gets rich, he wants to take Richard Branson's plane up and fly up into space and stuff. And I'm like, wow, you know, I don't know if I'd do that. I think if I could get a ride on one of the secret UFOs that we have, I might take one of those. But
it's good.
This whole business is pretty scary.
Hey, Mike, let's do this. We're gonna disconnect from you and call you back because your line's just a little bit choppy. I'll just keep talking. Okay. Don's going to go ahead and take care of you. He'll be right back on in 15 seconds. I don't know, man. I would buy a seat on Richard Branson's plane. If I had the spare money, that is one of the great things that I would set my sights on. Yeah, to see the Earth without having to jump at 700 miles an hour back toward the Earth and rely on a little silk parachute to keep my butt from splatting or bouncing, I would take a ride on Branson's plane. I would. I think it'd be a great honor. Mike will be back with us in just a second. It's sometimes Skype, you know, we get packet losses and various stuff like that, but he'll be back on in about 5 seconds. No worries. Sometimes, are you back with us, Mike? Okay. Sometimes when I go out at night or I get up early in the morning, you know, I leave for work before sunup. Hey, there you are, Mike.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. I can hear you.
Oh, there we are.
There we are.
Good, okay.
Okay.
Much better.
Sometimes when I go out early in the morning to go to work, I look up and I see the moon and I see Sirius and the Pleiades, you know, sitting up there in the Milky Way all splayed across the sky. I just have to stop and, you know, wait a couple minutes before putting the keys in the door and driving off because it is so spectacular to look up. And when I think about, you know, now there are only 11, but or a few, but at one time there were 12 guys that could look up there and have a more special memory about our moon than we do. Mm-hmm. But you have done some research that's absolutely phenomenal. By the way, Mike and I were side by side on a 2012 conference with George Norrie moderating, and to a packed house, by the way, standing room only in the back. Lots and lots of people are interested in this stuff, but what is it that got you excited about looking at the moon a little differently than I look at it every morning when I go to work?
Well, you know, it's actually what we were just talking about. It's that sense of adventure and human accomplishment and just the appreciation for the incredible, you know, the human desire to go somewhere we'd never been before and do something, or at least we thought we'd never done before. And to me, just I had this tremendous admiration for the adventure of space flight, and I guess that's why it ties into the jump today. It's the same kind of a thing. It's rare when I have that same feeling I had, you know, watching those missions. But you know, even as a little kid, watching Neil Armstrong's first step on the surface of the moon, I just always had this feeling that bothered me, that just they weren't showing us everything and they weren't telling us everything. And I mean, I remember asking my dad that night, July 20th, 1969, I said, you know, Dad, we have a color TV. How come all we can get is this terrible, awful black and white picture? And I said, I know the moon's far away, but, you know, don't TV signals, don't they kind of stay just as strong? And he said, yeah, they do. And he didn't really have a good answer for me. And yeah, I think from the very beginning, I've always kind of been looking for that thing out there, that maybe object that would fly past one of the Gemini spacecraft or something like that. I've always been looking for that, that something else that I felt like was out there, but that we weren't, either weren't getting to see or was just behind that next rock that we hadn't looked under yet. So for me, it was just a mystery that I guess I've always had. And, you know, and then as I grew older and started actually reading a few books on the subject, and then there was a great magazine, maybe you remember this, in the 1970s, it was called Saga, I think it was. And it was all about, it was called Saga Magazine, S-A-G-A, or Saga.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it was basically a combination of UFOs, you know, flying saucers, and almost naked girls. And it was like the best magazine I can ever, you know, for a 12-year-old in that time period, it was the best you could ever imagine. And I, you know, I just was curious, and I started reading books about stuff like this, and, you know, Somebody Else Is on the Moon, and some of these other books, and then as I, you know, got to be more grown up and listening to radio programs like yours and, you know, X Squared Radio and Coast to Coast, you begin to say, maybe I should start looking at some pictures. And of course, when I started looking at pictures, I started seeing a lot of stuff that should not have been there.
Now, how did you get a hold of the pictures? Because like the ones that we all find, they've been sanitized. They're all shrunk down to postcard size, and you know, we just look at them and say, well, there's no stars in the background because NASA tells us that you can't see stars when you're on the moon, and you know, everything's just, you know, cropped and perfect, and that's the way we look at it. But what do you see when you analyze these photographs?
Well, for one thing, there's tens of thousands of photographs that were taken of the moon. So, you know, when I started getting ready to put together Ancient Aliens on the Moon, I already had kind of a long history. I mean, I understood a lot of the history of this anomaly hunting and stuff. I knew a lot of the things that had been alleged about photographs before, and I knew how to take an image and look at it and scan it for stuff that, that doesn't look natural, because it's a very simple geologic model that NASA puts forth, which is basically that the moon formed one way or another, four and a half billion years ago, give or take. And it's just basically been bombarded by meteorites ever since. And so everything on the moon should be a crater or a mountain. There might be a few volcanic features, but they're also going to be beaten down. And everything should be nice and rounded and smooth and flowing. And there shouldn't really be anything geometric on the surface of the moon. So when I get a picture that maybe somebody tells me, oh, you know, you should look at this picture or look at this area, I start to look around for the things that don't fit that particular background. And a lot of times, you know, very quickly stuff jumps out at you. So it's just really a question of kind of knowing what belongs and what doesn't belong.
When you're looking at a photograph of a let's say a crater, you shouldn't see something that looks like a pyramid or a square box or something like that.
Absolutely. You should not see pyramids. You should not see triangles. You should not see right angle of roads and structures and walls running parallel for hundreds of miles across the surface of the moon. You should not see anything in the sky. NASA is correct. The sky should be absolutely pitch black. When you overexpose an image, you absolutely should not see anything there. Anything you do see in the sky above the moon is going to be, by definition, a local phenomenon. So whatever's there, it's local, and there shouldn't be anything in the sky because it should all be beaten down to dust at this point after 4.5 billion years. And, of course, when you do look on the surface of the moon, you see all kinds of stuff. I see machinery, vehicles. There's, you know, there's some extraordinary stuff around the rim of the crater Copernicus, which is a very chaotic kind of environment around the rim of the crater. But when you start to actually look at it, you see gaps. You see like parts where the skin of the moon has been torn apart, and you can see substructure underneath that, and it's all at right angles. And you see amazing things like, you know, what appear to be generators and buildings and tubes and pumps and drills and just these massive pieces of machinery and equipment and things like that. It's really pretty bizarre. And it's one of these things where, you know, I grew up working in engineering, and, you know, as an engineer, I can spot structures I see it. And you, I can certainly tell the difference between that and something that occurs naturally. And if you look in these certain areas where we've now sort of discovered that there are clusters of this these ruins, you basically can find amazing things. And hopefully, you know, I've put enough of them in the book that people have people are now beginning to realize that the moon is not exactly what NASA told us for the last.
Well, when you and I trust you have, you know, better sources for these photographs than most people do. And the only ones I've seen are like in Life magazine or what you can find on the internet, maybe a few dozen photographs. You've got access to archives that we don't have access to, but obviously these are pretty high resolution and some of them have been taken recently by Chinese and Japanese and different probes that we've sent up there, cruising at, you know, pretty decent altitudes, and there's no real atmosphere on the moon to worry about. So these are fairly high megapixel pictures. What happens when you start, you know, blowing them up and start zooming in on stuff?
You start seeing roads, bridges, buildings, drills, pumps, machinery, power plants, wheels, vehicles, tanks, gun emplacements. You start seeing things that just absolutely, you know, are the remnants of a very advanced civilization or civilizations. I would have to say a number of civilizations. And, you know, it is true that I do have access to some other stuff. There is a guy named Ken Johnston Jr. who I've written about in Ancient Aliens on the Moon, and Richard and I wrote about him in Dark Mission. And Ken worked at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory and at one time was in charge of all of the handheld photography that was taken by the NASA astronauts, whether they were in orbit or on the surface of the moon. And he had four complete sets, and NASA ordered him to destroy them all, but he actually kept one.
Oops.
And kept many of those photographs in his own collection, and some of them he gave away to his alma mater, but apparently somebody absconded with all those photographs, which is too bad because it's a treasure trove. So one of the things we've been able to do to answer the earlier question is I can look, if I'm interested in an area and I find a picture from one of the photo maps that should show me something I'm interested in a lot of cases I can ask Ken if he has it. If he says yes, he'll scan it for me, he'll email it to me, and I can compare that with what's online, the digital scan that NASA does. And unfortunately, what I have found on many occasions is that the current version online is not the same as the original print from, you know, the 1960s.
What's the difference? What are the differences between the ones online?
In many cases, you'll find that objects that are clearly easily identifiable as artificial, that definitely do not fit any model of lunar geology, are just not there. They're digitally erased. But it's bizarre because in some cases, like there's one very controversial object that I talk about in Ancient Aliens on the Moon, which is something that looks like a pyramid, looks like a ziggurat on the far side of the moon near the crater Daedalus, which is really directly on the back side of the moon. I'm sorry?
How big is this ziggurat?
Yeah. It's about 2 kilometers square, 2 kilometers across, and it is, it's clear as day in one image, and you go to the NASA digital version, and what they've done is they've taken away all the contrast in that particular area, so that you don't have any visual cues to sort of see the 3D shape of the thing. And then they actually drew in fake craters, and they painted in the shadows. They actually took a Photoshop paintbrush tool and paintbrushed in the shadows so that you can't see some of the details that you can see in the shadows from the original analog data. But the interesting thing about that particular image is that although they erased this pyramid, there's about a dozen other things in that picture that they didn't get, that they didn't apparently even know were there, that are just blatantly artificial and sticking out all over the place. And the whole area around Daedalus has just some amazing things. One of the most amazing was basically up on a hillside above this area that's photographed by the astronauts. Literally, there's what looks like a bunker cut into a hillside, and in the bunker is, and I'm not kidding, a flying saucer. It is some sort of flying saucer with legs, landing gear, and some sort of instrument or gun or something attached to the front of it. It's pretty bizarre. And around it is a bunch of other bizarre, obviously, architectural stuff. So So as you look at this, you know, I kind of look at this and I say to myself, this looks like something people would build. It doesn't necessarily look like something that aliens would build. So it's quite bizarre, Brooke. You know, I don't, sometimes I look at these images and I don't know, am I looking at one of our active bases on the moon? Am I looking at an abandoned base? Am I looking at, you know, something from what the Hopi called the third world of man, where the human race had evolved to the point where we were even smarter than we are today? Or am I looking at something completely alien? I don't know. A ziggurat is a specific kind of architecture, and it's very ancient human. So when I look at that, I say to myself, it looks to me like people built this. But
well, one of the things that always blew my mind as I watched that space shot in 1969 is, you know, I was always looking for the next shot. I thought that we had two completely built launch engines, you know, ready to go in 73, 74. We could have gone again, and we were even smarter. We had transistors. We had faster computers. And I thought the race was on. I thought the race was on, you know, like Donkey Kong. I thought we were going to be settling the moon. But 40 years later, nothing has happened. I mean, we're saying we haven't flown back to the moon. Now, I've got one of the welders that used to work for me when I was building biodiesel plants. His brother is a full bird colonel at NORAD. And mm-hmm. They live in Montana, so they were up in Montana in the wintertime at Christmas. A little bit too much Jack Daniels floating around. And the brother says, well, you know, we've been flying missions back and forth to the moon for 10 years. And my welder, you know, said to his brother, no kidding. Tell me more, because he knew I would.
Yeah, of course.
And of course, he came back and told me all this stuff, and I have his, you know, basically his brother's information, but I can't reveal it because he's still active duty. But I'm saying to myself, wait a minute. You mean the United States Air Force, or at least some division of it, has been flying back and forth to the moon for 10 years, not using rockets, and they haven't told us about it? What's going on?
Well, you know, that's interesting because it absolutely jives with another story. I have a friend who shall remain nameless, but I do know him and I do trust that he's telling me the truth. And he, back in the 60s, you know, he was a little kid and his dad worked at TRW, which was at the time, of course, a huge defense contractor and intimately involved in the space program. And they used to have a place up in Palos Verdes, you know, in California. And his dad was a big shot. And, I mean, he tells stories about sitting around, you know, the swimming pool with, you know, Gordon Cooper, Gus Grissom, Edgar Mitchell, people like that were all over to his dad's place for barbecues. And, you know, he specifically said, yeah, when I was 9 or 10 years old, you know, we're sitting there one night and Gus Grissom's had a couple. And he says, you know, we're just spamming a can. This Apollo craft they're putting us in is just garbage and they're going to get us all killed. And hell, they've been to the moon and back. They've been to the Mars and back. They've got technology that's out of this world. And, you know, we're just out there for the public show and, you know, we're really overexposed and I'm not going to fly. He kind of would make statements like, I'm not going to fly in this crap unless they give us something better. They should be giving us more of what they already have to get to the moon. So that absolutely drives the stories that go back as far as the 1960s. So, you know, I think a lot of flying saucers are actually our own technology that we've probably had.
Very interesting, very interesting. Hang on a second, Mike. We have a caller. Andrew, line two, you're on the program. Welcome to X Squared Radio.
Yeah, good evening. I'd like to know why Mike Barra accuses his critics of being homosexual. He's done that several times.
Well, first of all,
every time that somebody criticizes his work, he insinuates that they're homosexual. What's the point of that?
Well, in your case, Martin, you probably are. But the thing is, this guy, Brooks, this guy is not, his name is not Andrew. He is a cyber-stalking psychopath. His name is Martin Blaze, as near as I can tell. I have an investigator investigating him, and we're going to be actually filing a restraining order against the guy in the very near future. So this is typical of what I've been getting. This guy that just called in, he's just a nutbag. And it's really interesting is that the more books that I publish, the more of this kind of flack that I get. And I don't understand it other than I think that it's just like there's just people that are just really made uncomfortable by the kinds of discussions that people like you and me have and the kinds of books that we write.
Yeah, well, that's true. It's unfortunate that we have these kind of people come on. I was on George Norrie one time, and some guy called in and asked me what race I was, and George said, "You don't have to answer that." And I said, "No, that's okay. I don't mind. I'm Scottish." And you know, millions of people just cracked up, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, well, this particular guy, and it's really interesting because I got into a big dispute, a big controversy with a guy from that's funded by NASA named Dr. Stuart Robbins, and unfortunately, this crazy guy who just called in has been feeding Dr. Robbins a lot of information. And, of course, like a lot of NASA guys, there's a lot of people in NASA that are just so dumb, they actually believe that NASA tells the truth about stuff. And they're just, unfortunately, they're just kind of naive. And so, you know, it's kind of this weird, ugly underground that just goes out of their way to attack anybody who presents any information that is an alternative to the accepted orthodoxy. And, you know, unfortunately, I've been getting a lot more of this crap lately, but I guess I should take it as sort of a badge of honor because it means that I'm getting noticed. That means that people are interested in me, and that apparently threatened me to someone. So they have to come on and make things up about me, and it's bizarre. I mean, literally, they will. This guy will take this guy and other people like him. They will take something I said, you know, from something in 2007 that I wrote, and then something from today, and they'll slice them together and make it look like something I said, something that I never said, and then demand that if I don't defend this very thing that I said, which I never said, that, you know, obviously I don't have any credibility. It's bizarre, well, but I guess it just means I'm getting more important.
Yeah, sometimes it's great to be famous, and sometimes it's not. And by the way, a message going out there, all you other, you know, homosexual, anti, you know, space people, don't call in Dex Frederick.
This guy, you know where that comes from? It's very funny. I said, you know, buddy, you're so obsessed with me, I'm just sure you have a poster of me at home. Well, I'm not going to say it on your program. Poster of me at home with certain kinds of stains on it.
My goodness. Well, listen, there are other radio programs that they can call into that are
okay.
Welcome, but they're not welcome here. Everybody knows this is scientific talk radio for your mind.
Well, so
what I'm trying to get to here, and I think that you've really broken open something here that is not only so fascinating and controversial, but there are a tremendous amount of facts to back it up, not just photographic facts, but there are testimony mm-hmm. from real astronauts that have flown real missions, from real Air Force officers that are active duty, that are serving right now. And mm-hmm. I don't think that there's one out of 500 Americans, or any other race for that matter on this planet, any other civilization, that hasn't seen a UFO flying up there in the sky. And some of these are making left-hand turns at 10,000 miles an hour. And I think just about everybody is saying, well, those have to be, you know, not only the UFOs, but they're from another world. But you're saying that might not be true, that we might have craft that can do that.
Yeah, I don't think it's true. And, you know, well, there's stuff like, for instance, some of the space shuttle videos, STS-48 and my favorite, STS-80. I don't know if you're familiar with those cases, but in both cases, it's pretty obvious that the shuttle, whoever was running the camera, was waiting for the show to start. They were looking for something. And people see this, you know, performance, the performance of these vehicles in space that are obviously powered vehicles. And they think, oh, well, they must be aliens. But then what do they expect? Does that mean really that what the aliens called and said, by the way, we're going to be over Bolivia at 33 degrees at this particular time, and you should have your cameras running so you can catch us on tape? I mean, it's really kind of crazy to even think that that's a possibility. So, again, I think what we're looking at is you know, recording tests of the secret space program that's been in place from the very, very beginning. In fact, as far back as the 1950s, there's a lot of research that was done on counter-rotating magnetic fields and different ways to generate propulsion and energy. Wernher von Braun was very interested in this. In the late 1950s and early 60s, I talk about this in The Choice, my second book, because, you know, he had a big problem with Explorer 1. It went it went way farther, way higher, way faster than it should have, and he didn't understand that, and it took him several years to figure it out. But right away, he started digging into all of this research, this alternative research into field propulsion theories, and then about 1960, it just all disappeared. And, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that seems to have vanished from the discussion.
There are a lot of people doing research in this stuff.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's most interesting, and I wish I had the graph, and I wish this was the thing we could show your listeners, but there is a graph that my buddy Richard Hoagland made, and he shows basically the speed of transportation, starting with, you know, a human being can run about, what, at the most, I don't know, 18 miles an hour, and then you've got the horse, and then you've got, after the horse, you've basically got the automobile and the train, and then the propeller-driven airplane, and then the jet airplane, and then the rocket. And so as you go up this curve, basically the curve just starts with just a human being walking, and then it just takes off and goes straight up. And then in 1960, this accelerating curve, which should go on, you know, on that same path, that same glide path vertically, it just goes straight horizontal. And since 1960, we have not been able to advance one step. Now, does anybody really believe that technologically, in terms of the speed of our propulsion systems, our transportation, that we've really made no advancements about 1960 since the invention of the rocket? It just doesn't make any sense. And if you look at the curve of technology, the curve of knowledge, the next thing that would have been a breakthrough, something along the lines of UFO technology, some sort of field propulsion that would have allowed us to go, you know, millions of miles an hour at the very least and defy gravity. And yet we didn't do that. We've just stopped and not advanced any further. And really, Brooks, it kind of goes back to your same question of why did we stop going to the moon? Well, we didn't. We just went underground.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Maybe the curve really does continue on up. It's just not revealed to the public. Maybe we don't want other societies to get a hold of the technology. Hey, we have one more caller. Lyle from Indiana, you're on line two. Welcome to X Squared Radio.
Good evening, Mr. Agnew and Mr. Brer.
How are you?
Hi. Fine, and you?
Oh, we're doing great. I trust you people in Indiana are going to do the right thing next month when it comes to the election. So welcome to the program.
Who knows? You know, at one point I said there's a chance, in my mind I said there's a chance for us to save it. But the more we go forward, and you could see just the corruption of appearing in the newspaper, and nothing happens to those who are doing, you know, the wrong thing, I said, the more and more I look at it, the more and more I understand that this system has to fall, and that a lot of people, nobody's going to do anything until they get hurt, which is unfortunate. But that's just the realization that I've come to.
Well, I think you're right. You know, I was going to say before you get to your question, that's kind of what my second book, The Choice, is about, and Brooks and I talked about this on the panel, which was just basically that, look, we're in a situation where energetically everything is aligned for revolution. Everything is aligned right now for people to just have enough. The question is, and what you're putting out there, I think, is, you know, what's going to be the triggering event? I don't know that we know that yet, but I feel like it's coming. I agree with you.
Right. Okay. What I was going to say, because I was listening to you as you were talking about UFOs and where they come from, and what I actually think is that they're coming from all over. They're coming from different dimensions, different worlds, places in this universe, vast differences. So I think it's just a hodgepodge, and, you know, people get hung up on whether they're, you know, from some distant planet, and then they want to reject from a different dimension or a different universe, but I think it's all in play. And I think something's going to happen with this planet that may not happen on a regular basis, and they're coming here to observe it. And there are some that are, I think that want to make man its slave, and some that want to see us rise, but the ones that want to see us rise aren't interfering because it's something that we have to overcome ourselves.
Well, you know, Lyle, we were talking about this in the 2012 conference, and one of the things that we discussed was how the advent of 2012 is actually affecting humankind. Do we sit here as spectators and kind of watch it all happen just the way the prophets have described, and we kind of march on to Armageddon unempowered to do anything about it? Or are we empowered, having a little bit of information from the Maya, a little bit from, you know, the Babylonians and from the Sumerians and from the Egyptians and from Christians and from prophets, and maybe we could choose a new future? Maybe the whole reason the Earth is here and we're here all at the same time is so we can do something about it.
Well, I watch different shows, and one thing that I watch is it's Ghost Adventures, and I see them put the and I'm gonna show you how it all ties together. But they put these little EM pods down to give spirits energy to try to do something, manifest, talk, or whatever. But, and I think, you know, I keep thinking, and so I thought 2012, that's when we're supposed to align with the galactic center and the black hole that puts out a lot of energy. And then I can't remember where it's from, but they were saying that we would see, and I can't remember if it was a TV show or a book that I read, but basically they were saying that we would see basically demons, maybe angels. And so I'm thinking, well, maybe that's from the energy that's going to inundate this planet, this solar system, that we'll start to awaken. Because one of the things that I've always thought is that man didn't talk, but we had the telepathic abilities and other abilities, and then something happened that took it away, and now we might be back on the cusp of it. And I think that's why you see the Illuminati, they're just coming out and they're saying we could do this, but they want us to live in fear. And you see a lot of on these channels where they talk about the end of the world and how things will be without man, because they're trying to put that in our minds so that it translates to reality. But I think it's a futile attempt on their part.
Yeah. Well, you bring up a really good point. I'd like Mike to address it, because we are talking about ancient aliens on the moon, and the suggestion was made that maybe we were the ancient aliens. So what about it, Mike? When did the big dumb down happen?
Well, you know, it's pretty interesting. I think that the last time was probably about 13,000 years ago, because if you look at this 26,000-year processional cycle, and again, this is more about stuff that I wrote in The Choice, the second book that I wrote, but it does tie in with ancient aliens on the moon, because you have this 26,000-year cycle where you have these alignments and this energy comes from the center of the galaxy, and we are experiencing that now, and we're going to continue to experience it for a while. And I think what happens is that, you know, if we are not progressing the way we as a race, the human race, would like to be progressing, we reach a point where we have a choice. I call the book The Choice. And the choice is, do we decide that this is okay, that we can fix this, that we can make this particular civilization, this version of man, better, and we keep going forward, or do we say, no, this is not really working, and we wipe the slate clean and we start over again? And I think in the past we've made that decision that we're going to wipe the slate clean and start over again. And so when you're talking about ancient ruins on the moon, ancient alien ruins on the moon, they could be us. They could be from what the Hopi called it, that third world of man, the third version of the human race. It could have been only as recently as maybe 26,000 or even 13,000 years ago, when there was some sort of cataclysm that was created by our energetic desire to wipe the slate clean. And that's really interesting, because that's exactly what the Hopi say too. They say you always reach a point where you can go on with, you know, the intellect disconnected from the heart. But if you keep on that path, there will be chaos and destruction. However, if you go back to the reintegration, the way man is supposed to be, where we, you know, it's just as valid to know something intuitively as it is to know something intellectually and physically and touch it and prove it, where you give equal value to both of those, then you can be in a more harmonious state with nature, and you don't have to have the physical calamity. So, I mean, I think the guy's dead on, and basically it's the philosophy that I put out in the choice, trying to emphasize to people that we have an impact on what has happened before to this planet and what will happen in the future. So it's really important that we be aware of all these truths about our history. And you know, basically ancient aliens on the moon is part of that. I'm trying to point out to people that aliens have been here, they've intervened in human affairs, and humans have been very advanced before. And, you know, we didn't go from, you know, stupid cavemen with stone knives and bearskins to smart us with our striped toothpaste or hydrogen bombs necessarily in one straight line. We can go up and down on a cycle. The question is, this time, are we going to get off the cycle? Are we going to decide that there's something to build on here and we're going to move forward? And again, this is why, Bert, this goes back to the energy that we've got in this call or this show tonight and this guy calling in, because the things that you're talking about, what the caller's talking about, what was his name again? I'm sorry, somebody on us.
Lyle.
Lyle. What Lyle's talking about and what I'm talking about, you know, we're making about 50% of the people out there uncomfortable. They just want to go on with their lives. They want to believe that there's nothing unusual in the universe, that there's nothing higher than this existence, that only what they know and money and those things are the most important things. They're made very uncomfortable by spiritual beliefs. They're made very uncomfortable by beliefs that shake the foundations of the hierarchies and structures that they believe in.
That's true. I want to say, make life a little more complicated for them, that's for sure.
Right. And so that makes them uncomfortable, and that's where you get the hatred and the vicious, you know, reaction, because you're taking them out of their comfort zone. And what I will tell you, Lyle, is that a couple things. First of all, I have some friends that are psychic mediums that I firmly believe have that ability and are connected to something higher. And what they've told me is that there are more ghosts incarnated on this planet right now than they have ever seen in their lifetime. And I think it has something to do with 2012 and this energy. And I think everybody's coming back to see what choice we make, to see what's going to happen. I think it's probably the best show in the galaxy right now. So you've got aliens, you've got interdimensional beings, you know, you've got 3D aliens, you've got hyperdimensional aliens, and you've got all the people that have been here before. They're kind of all gathered right now at this point in history for us to decide what's our future going to be, and are we going to wipe the slate clean, or are we going to go forward and try to fix this situation, the civilization?
I don't suppose they're going to give us any hints either. What do you think, Lyle?
Well, I think we're going to make it, but I think it's going to be a lot of pain to go through. The other thing that I wanted to mention is,
yep,
I think man is older also. The reason why I say that is because I do think that that we have explored in the way distant past, that we have explored the universe, maybe even the parallel dimensions, parallel universes. And I think that's why, you know, some of these other races know to come to visit. They want to see that we're at a pivotal point, and they want to see if we're going to make it or collapse. And like I said, I really believe that we're going to make it. And I wanted to also point to, I don't know if you've ever heard, read Edgar Cayce, and he talked about the pyramids and how the pyramids were used to basically ascend and to travel the universe. And so I think that's another connection we made. He also made reference to Atlantis and the crystal, and we were helped in developing the crystals from somebody from another place. But the other thing I wanted to ask Mr. Barrera is if he examined any of the. There was a race that said that there was the Earth without the Moon, and if he ever covered that, because there's a out there, there's a thought that the Moon was captured by the Earth, and not that it was came from the Earth.
Well, there.
Sorry, go ahead, Brooks.
One is Moon capture theory, and the other is Earth capture theory.
Right.
And I would say that the most prevalent one right now is that the Earth was here, or that the Moon was here and captured the Earth.
Okay. I actually hadn't heard that one. I you know, there's the moon capture theory, which I talk about this in Ancient Aliens on the Moon. There's the Moon capture theory, which doesn't work. There's the accretion theory, which doesn't work, and there's the big whack theory, which doesn't work. And so what I'm left with is the original theory, which was discarded for reasons I think are a little bit shaky, which is the fission theory, which is that the moon did come from the Earth. And what's consistent in that is that I think they did a test on the titanium oxygen isotopes recently, and they discovered essentially that the moon is made out of the same stuff as the Earth. And if that was the case, then none of the other theories could really be correct. So the problem is that there's a difference in angular momentum. There's some missing angular momentum, and that creates kind of a problem in at least to the mainstream scientist theory. But they had all bought into the big whack theory, which is that a Mars-sized object struck the Earth back in the primordial days, and the moon was siphoned off from the debris of these, you know, what was left of the Earth and this other big Mars-sized object. But if that was the case, then the compositions of the two planets, the Earth and the Moon, would be different, and they're not. And the Moon is basically made from the light mantle material of the Earth, which is the upper crust stuff. So think originally, you know, it was part of the Earth. And there's a whole another theory that I want to talk to you about. I talk about this in The Choice in my second book, and also it's a theory by the late Dr. Tom Van Flander, who wrote a book called Dark Matter, Missing Planets, and New Comets, and which is the fission theory of planetary formation, which argues that essentially all the planets are spun off by the primordial sun. That's why the planets have all the angular momentum. And then in that theory, the big gas giant would spin off small rocky moons, and the smaller terrestrial planets closer to the sun, like the Earth and Venus, would spin off one single large moon. And, you know, having read through that theory, I'd have to say that it may not be perfect yet, but it's the one that, to me, is most consistent with the data that's out there right now.
But I thought I had heard that, well, they were saying the heavier metals on the moon were on the top, and usually you find them more as you go to the core. So I would think that if it was a part of the Earth and it had that angular momentum, it would form basically the same way, where you had the heavier metals as you went down. But these are all on top. Not only that, but you have the issue where they crashed a satellite into the moon and it rang like a bell,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, if we had something that dropped on ours, we wouldn't ring like a bell. And I know the atmosphere is different and all that, but, you know, that still creates an issue in my mind. So I'm not really sure
A lot of people don't know this, but the first missions up there and all subsequent missions since then, the astronauts were trained in geology. They actually set geophones on the moon. And that's why we were able to tell that the moon rang like a bell. But one of the things that they were there to do, of course, was take geological samples or lunar-logical samples. And one of the things that we discovered is that the moon is primarily made of titanium and aluminum, while the Earth is primarily made of iron and nickel. So obviously these are surface measurements, and we haven't done any drilling into the core of the moon. But that's why I thought it was kind of peculiar when people think that the moon was spun off out of the Pacific Bay Basin or the Gulf of Mexico Basin. The two are basically the same age, but from a homologous point of view, they're quite different in atomic makeup.
Well, but everything that the moon is made of, the Earth, it comes from Earth. The Earth has. So it's not as though it's made up
so
of anything
Venus.
That's not of the Earth. So, there, you know, yeah, you're right. It's aluminum, titanium, and glass, primarily, is what's on the surface of the moon. And to go back to the thing about it ringing, you know, again, what I talk about in Ancient Aliens on the Moon is that if you overexpose a lot of images of the lunar surface, what you will find is that in the background, in the darkness, where there should be absolute pitch blackness, you will find these massive interlocking, semi-transparent, if not almost completely transparent, structures that I think are made of lunar glass that were built as massive, I mean, in some cases, 20 miles high, meteor shields over the planet. And that is what is ringing, not necessarily the moon interior structure, which may or may not be hollow. There is some other information that Hoagie has come up with that he's never talked about, that I've never talked about, that may indicate there's some very large hollow caverns inside the moon. But, you know, I think the moon started out as a natural object that was heavily, heavily, heavily modified after that.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, given the factual evidence that you've revealed in your book, the fact that there's equipment and it's been there for a long, long time, and the moon is a tremendous wealth of pure metals, pure refined metals, and it's also a low-gravity launch point into deeper points in space. Given the fact that we really have three bodies in our solar system that we know now have had life on them, which would be Mars, our moon, and Earth, and we're not sure about Io or about some of the other moons in around Saturn. But
I would add Europa to that, actually.
Europa, exactly.
And maybe Venus, but Venus has had such a number done on it that I don't think we'll ever really find the proof of it. But, yeah.
Had a lot of missions to Venus, so we know something about it, although they're not revealing much, I have to say. I don't understand. I mean, NASA is a publicly funded organization, agency of the government. Why don't they release everything they have? What's the big deal about keeping stuff moon secret?
Can I say that? You know, something that I didn't realize was that NASA was never a civilian organization. It was always a military. That's why you had these pilots and most of the men on the mission were in the military, so that they could keep it's secret, whatever they wanted. So, you know, I'm not surprised. And you know, I guess I've become jaded. Anything that I hear from the government, and I guess not, but I always have to take with a grain of salt. Are they telling us the truth? If they're telling us the truth, how much is the truth and how much is a lie? Because in the 80s, they came out and said in the newspaper that if they deemed it necessary, that they would lie to us. So at that point, how can you have any faith in any government organization if they say that they have the right to lie to you?
You're exactly right. I mean, we didn't trust them then, but we trust them now, right?
Right.
I don't know, Mike, where are we going with this? I mean, who eventually is going to get control of this government and say, okay, boys, it's time to open up the vaults. Let's tell the people what really has been going on for the past 40 years.
Well, remember, Brooks, you had the most brilliant line on the 2012 panel last weekend, which was that if you have one great idea, you're a genius. If you have two great ideas, you're a crackpot. That was the best line of the day, for sure. But what I say consistently to people is, you know, look, we're in the middle of an apocalypse. But the question is, what is an apocalypse? What does that mean? Apocalypse simply means, the word literally means, to lift the veil, right? The lifting of the veil to reveal that which has been hidden, it means revelation. So, again, this 2012 energy field that we're in and that I think we're going to be in until like 2023 is going to force all kinds of things out into the public. Now, a lot of people, especially in the UFO community, they want this government disclosure. They think that you know, Obama or, you know, whoever's the president of the corporation is going to sit there someday and stand in front of the TV and say, yes, there's aliens. Yes, we've lied to you for 50 years. All the UFO investigators have been right. Stanton Friedman is a hero. You know, Richard Dolan's a genius. That's never going to happen, okay? What is going to happen is that this energy that we're in, this 2012 energy, is going to force these truths into the public. And guys like you that have your programs and the books that we write, things like Ancient Aliens on the Moon, are part of that process. And simply the revelation of this information is going to cause upset and conflict and change, and it's not ever going to ever be really acknowledged by the people at the top. You have to understand, the people at the top are politicians and businessmen, in essence, and they're already at the top. And if they upset the apple cart, where do they go? They have no place to go but down. So why would any of these people ever give us some sort of official disclosure? I don't think they would, and I think that these UFO guys, Nick Pope, I think they're just barking up a tree and thinking that someday they're going to get a big pat on the back from the government, and they're going to be on Oprah, and they're going to be big heroes, and that's just not going to happen. What's going to happen is bit by bit.
Isn't the idea, though, isn't the idea to take that learning curve of travel, a speed that we travel, and make a left-hand turn and go up again instead of going horizontal? You know, we're just, 100 years or so beyond horseback. Can't we just make a left-hand turn again and go further out?
I guess you're talking about technologically. You're right. We could be. You got to think about this, Brooks. If it was suddenly to come out that we had this hyper-dimensional technology, we had the ability to build UFOs, we can go to the moon, we can go to Mars anytime we want, we have essentially unlimited energy. If you have unlimited energy, then what is the next thing that follows? Everything becomes free. Nothing costs anything. Therefore, you have no economy. So before you can reveal that information to people, how do you bring these technologies into the public without being able to charge for them? Because then you don't have a commercial structure. And do you really want to live in a world where everybody's rich? Because if you have that, guess what? Who's going to dig the ditches and shovel the you-know-what? So that to me, I think, is the dilemma. And that's why a lot of these things are suppressed. And in a lot of cases, these people think they're doing it for our own good.
Well, I would disagree with the politicians would never tell you. They would tell you if they could benefit from it.
Right.
I don't think, and I don't think that there would be a big uprising with the people if you told them, hey, we have this technology, which I think those technologies, if the collapse comes, those technologies will appear because of the, you know, if you don't have any gas to put in your car, then that forces you to find another means to run your vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. So I can actually see them coming about because of the collapse. But as far as the politicians, they will do it if they can gain from it. The only thing, they might be able to gain from it in the beginning, but over time, I think that they would lose that power. I agree with you. They're already on top. They don't want to give that power up. They want us to live in fear so that we look to them as a way out, but as we keep looking toward them, we just keep getting deeper and deeper in the doo-doo.
Which is why this period right now is very interesting, because it's becoming more and more obvious, and Brooks, we talked about this on the panel last Sunday, that, you know, I think it's becoming more and more obvious that Obama is going to lose. I mean, he's going to lose badly on November the 6th. And so the question becomes is, you know, does he bring something out in the open to try to shift this? Because I think the only chance he has of getting reelected is if something very dramatic shifts everybody's perceptions between now and election day. The question is going to be, what is that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Lyle, we're at the top of the hour. I really appreciate the call, and I want you to call back again because you're a great caller. Thanks for hanging with us for the last half hour.
It's been my pleasure, and thanks for taking my call.
Hey, no problem, no problem. Call back every Sunday if you want.
Okay.
All right,
thanks. Yeah. Good night.
Good night. Mike, can you hang with me for another half hour?
Sure, I can do that.
Hey, that's cool. That's cool. I want to cover some more stuff. We'll take a quick break. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming to you right after this. A little bit of, Leonard Cohen, if you like it. Here we go.
Hi.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Humbly before the Lord of Song, we bring the final hour of X Squared Radio to you tonight with our guest, Michael Barra. This is Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen, sung by Jody Alana Morgan, one of the better cuts that I own. And I appreciate your patience wading through it. Michael Barra is the author of Ancient Aliens on the Moon. It's been quite a lively discussion for the last hour. We've got him for about another 20 or 30 minutes, so if you want to call in, make sure you do so. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back. Great, great song. Really interesting. Did you ever see the film Watchmen?
Oh, yeah. It was actually Leonard Cohen singing that song while they were up in the ship making love. That must be cool.
You know, it's funny how there's all this synchronicity. While you were, you know, playing that song, I just happened to just go to Facebook, and one of my friends had a picture of her with Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who played the comedian in that movie, and I'm like, that's kind of weird. You know, how does that weird connection come out of the sky like that? But it's just part of the physics, I guess. It's part of the physics that shows that we're all connected.
It's a part of X Squared Radio. Absolutely. That's just the magic that happens here every single week. And, you know, I got to tell you, when I went to Conscious Live Expo, I guess it's the first time I've been there in about 4 years. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those magical places. You get all these great minds, Mike Barra, you get Richard C. Hoagland, you get George Noory, you get John, who is John? Who was John, the guy that was the...
John Hoag, the Nostradamus guy, is that who you're talking about?
Yeah, the Nostradamus guy. Wow, that
John
was...
John Hoag, yeah. Yeah.
What an amazing intellect.
Mm-hmm.
And just amazing people that are all about, you know, being part of the earth changes, trying to make themselves aware as they can about the facts and where to be and what to do and how to think and how to spread the word and get the word out. And it's just an amazing energy that takes place twice a year down there at the Conscious Life Expo.
Yeah, we got to get you back out there in February because that's the much bigger energy. And that's the one we really got to get you at, because that way you can reach even more people than in the October show.
Well, I definitely am open for it. Absolutely. One of the things that that I guess makes this program special is the quality of guest that comes on this program, because we only come on once a week. And we don't have guests every single week in the month. Sometimes we just have a lot of news, and we open lines, and we talk about it. So this is one of those rare times when we have, you know, one of the, I think, you know, not only great minds, but great explorers in this genre, and that's you. And I just want you to know how much I appreciate you coming on tonight and sharing your ideas. So if we're talking about ancient excavations that have gone on the moon, whether they're mining or whether they're space exploration, do you think it was part of the mission here on Earth? I would have to think so, because I wouldn't think anyone would come from far away and not come to Earth. They would go to the moon. I mean, it had to be tied to the whole exploration of this entire orbit, what's going on right here.
Yeah, it's a good question, and to me there's no doubt that you're correct, that whatever bases were on the moon, whether they're the new stuff or the old stuff, have no question something to do with what's going on here on the Earth and what has gone on for billions of years. And, you know, if you look at the history of how life evolves, I think Lloyd Pye is one of the best people at sort of describing the reality of what the fossil record shows, which is that, you know, there's these big explosions of different kinds of life that just kind of were introduced all of a sudden onto the Earth. And, you know, it's I think most likely what a lot of these structures are and bases are the laboratories where, you know, some of these forms of life were concocted and then introduced into the biosphere to kind of see what happened and watched over for a long time. And I suspect that that's a lot of what's on the moon, in addition to the stuff we talked about earlier, which is from, you know, our own structures and And then, of course, there's Zechariah Sitchin's Anunnaki. It's probably some of their stuff. And there's no question that, that whoever was up there was working on, you know, they were there to do something here on Earth. There's no question.
Yeah, because Earth is, you know, a very rare planet in the in a corner of the Milky Way galaxy. It would show up like a blue jewel from millions of miles away. We have one more caller. Robin, you're on line two. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Agnew. Hi, Mike. I've got three quick questions, but I'm going to fire and let you answer as we go because I want to build on this. But I remember you saying earlier that, well, we couldn't let this energy, if we have advanced energy, okay, out there because you think it would kind of destroy the infrastructure of an economy, except for you can use energy to produce things, but you still have to be able to buy food and clothes and things like that. So having free energy wouldn't necessarily inhibit all those processes, but what it might do is make the quality of life a little bit better. In other words, more people could afford to do certain things because they wouldn't have to put gas in their cars to run it on energy systems or small energy systems, unless you see this energy as being something extremely dangerous in an individual. Do you?
Well, everything that's produced by an economy it starts with energy, okay? Everything, if you don't have cheap energy, you are not going to have a growing economy. It's that simple. And right now, we have a very expensive energy, just like we did back in the late 1970s, and we have a stagnant economy. And that's the biggest, I think, one of the biggest reasons why we have a stagnant economy is the simple fact that you have to have this energy to cheap energy to grow an economy. The truth is, if you have unlimited energy, it's only a matter of time, very quickly, before everything does become free and there's no economy at all. Because, again, if it costs you nothing to produce something, if it costs you nothing to build steel girders, then where do you get off charging somebody for your steel girders?
Because it costs labor.
Energy?
Because it costs
again, it's an interesting question,
labor.
But...
it costs labor and time.
Labor is human energy. But again, labor is human energy. And if a machine can replace that human labor, then how do you charge for human labor? So I think that's
the
question
that they've
been grappling with. Well,
but
again,
I mean,
I understand we have a philosophical difference here. You may be right. I'm not saying you're not correct. I'm just saying that what I see is that very quickly, all the machines are built with all the power at your fingertips, you know, then everything becomes free. Well, because you simply, it costs you nothing to do anything. You have unlimited energy. And really, I think that's the
You could have quality of life. Then you could do things like art. You could do, you know, you'd still want to be active doing things. You could be more creative, and you'd like that's where you would get into the arts and things like that.
Well, if you remember, that's kind of where we were. I mean, back in the 50s and 60s, oil was like $8 or $9 a barrel. It was like, you know, it was the cheapest energy on the planet. It's still pretty cheap. You know, it's, you know, to take you and your friends a mile for 20 or 30 cents. Is, you know, you couldn't get a person in a rickshaw to, you know, pulling a rickshaw to take you and your friends a mile for 20 or 30 cents. Oil is still a pretty cheap form of energy, but we have to distribute it and refine it. Same with electricity. We have to generate it, then we have to distribute it, we have to meter it, all of that, you know, all of the labor that goes into it. Even if we came up with a new source of energy like cold fusion or, you know, some perpetual magnetic machine that generates electricity, Robin's right. You'd still have to have hundreds of factories making it for 100 years to get it distributed around the planet.
Well, I don't know that it would take 100 years.
Designer clothes. You know, those would always be ongoing.
We're just kind of off on a side discussion here, but the truth is that I don't think it would take 100 years at all, Brooks. I think, you know, with the power of human innovation and unlimited energy sources, I think very quickly we're going to have basically everything at our fingertips that we could ever imagine. And then we have, you know, the forbidden planet problem, the Krell problem, which is what if this ability to have unlimited energy falls into the hands of not so nice people. And that's another reason why I think a lot of these things are kept out of the public, because they don't want them to fall into the hands of people yeah. who would use it for evil purposes. And I believe that that's part of three-dimensional reality, is dealing with the not so nice folks out there.
Well, I've got a question then. What if you protected it? Like, okay, you did charge for it, and in charging for it, you would that's free energy so that it could be distributed. You know, like we have two electrical lines now. I mean, we don't all run power plants, nuclear power plants, but we get our power from it. Do you think this energy could be housed or secured so that it would at least produce and send out and be, you know, secured so that we could at least use the benefits of it, you know, like powering our house and factories and things like that?
Yeah, it would be great if that were the case. I mean, I know that Arthur C. Clarke discussed on many occasions the fact that, according to him, in Europe, that it was a fairly easy thing to do to get yourself one of the Pons Fleischmann cold fusion cells, and you could power your house on it for, you know, I don't know, 100 years and never have to buy electricity again, and that this was actually a fairly common thing, according to him, in Europe, but you just don't hear anything about it in the U.S., and that may be true, that may not be true, but the question then becomes is, you know, how do you keep the genie in the bottle? It's the same thing that we're experiencing now with atomic weaponry, okay? You know, 60 years ago, there was one atomic power in the United States. Now there are, I think, 7 or 8. We're on the brink of Iran getting nuclear power. And nuclear power, compared to this hyperdimensional energy source, is like a kitchen bomb compared to a hydrogen bomb. I mean, you're talking about levels of magnitude greater destructive power. So, it's like, wow, it would be great if we could bring this stuff out, but you've got to really keep the genie in the bottle, because once people know it exists, then eventually they can figure out how to get there. I mean, we're not the only guys on the planet that are smart here in the U.S., as we, you know, as we've discovered recently. So, okay, I don't know. I would like to see it, but I just think that there's too much.
Do you think it would take a lot of education then prior to that, or do you think in doing it they could kind of educate, bring people up to a level, up to speed, so they would respect it? And if it would ease the quality of life for people, you know, if people weren't starving and could live in better housing and things like that,
yeah,
maybe they wouldn't be so volatile, you know, if their needs, basic needs were met, so there was quality mm-hmm. there. Do you think less volatile?
There's a difference between putting a unit on someone's house that will provide them, you know, cheap or even free electricity for the next 100 years, and dropping an unlimited supply of rice into a third world country. In one case, you have, you know, the maturity and the intellect to be able to handle a newer, freer, you know, cleaner, even cheaper a source of energy. On the other hand, you have a generally immature society that with an overabundance of food would very quickly overpopulate their country and spill over into other countries. Now, I'm not saying that as a racist thing, but in any biological system, and Michael can appreciate this as an engineer, if you tilt one of the inputs to any formula, you skew the results or the output of that formula or that machine in an unpredictable manner. So you got to be very careful how you put radically new, plentiful sources of energy into any economy. It's got to be let into the system very slowly.
Well, I've got a question then, too. This galactic kind of moves into the consciousness and the galactic plane that we're moving into and the frequency waves that we may be exposed to. Mike, do you have a theory on whether we will literally be affected by this, like our minds and the frequencies will maybe up people a level of understanding in that, and consciousness, that improvements will be made in how they view things and possibly a change come from that? Do you think it will happen?
Yeah, I think it's already happening, and I think that you know, what's happening energetically now, and this is what I talk about in The Choice. I didn't know I'd be talking so much about The Choice tonight, but it's okay because this is a great discussion. But what's happening right now is polarization. You know, the good gets much, much better. The bad gets much, 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 much worse, which Mr. Hoagland said this weekend. And that's the situation we're in now. And the reason for that is to get us to decide which side of the fence we're going to fall on, each of us. Now, those of us that choose to move forward into a better place, into a less materialistic place, perhaps, we're going to have it better. But I think the people that get left behind that make a different choice are not going to have such a good time over this next period. So it's kind of up to us to decide how this is all going to come out, and then it's going to be up to those of us that do get a little boost or even a big boost from this 2012 energy to be the leaders and teachers and even caretakers of the people that choose to stay down in the lower vibrations in the old ways. So I don't see how it can be a universal thing on the earth for a long time. I mean, I've said a lot when I talked about The Choice that what The Choice could be is simply that 50.0000001% of the human race decides that they want to become more connected to God, more spiritual, more connected to something higher, and more loving. And that choice may not manifest itself for hundreds or even thousands of years before all of us on the planet kind of get caught up. You know, it's interesting But there's one other point about this, which is that, you know, you said if everybody's material needs are met, you know, will all the strife go away? Well, again, I give you the example of Osama bin Laden, whose every material need was met, yet still chose a path of violence, death, destruction. And so I think it's part of human nature, and until fundamentally human nature changes, which I'm not sure it's ever going to, because I think maybe part of the whole lesson we're here for, well, the reason we're all human is to have all these conflicts, until human nature evolves, I don't think it's going to be safe to put that kind of stuff out there. I agree with Brooks. I don't think it's safe.
Okay, well, I'm thinking, would abilities come with this? Like, you know how people now can miraculously heal, you know, they can have spontaneous healings because they have their consciousnesses in line. You know, they believe they're going to, which you could say is more spiritual. The placebo effect that works on people because they believe this pill is going to do it. Would this frequency, would this change enhance those abilities where people literally could start, you know, noticing some effects and get some gifts from this that they would be applying, which would also encourage other people who see that go, well, gee, because Osama bin Laden still had kidney failure and he still had to be on a dialysis machine. So he didn't get everything the way he wanted it. But let's say if you are in alignment and, like you said, you decide to go with the good, and with the good comes these abilities of being healthier and being able to heal and being able to do things, you know, better, do you think that would be a potential of that? And I'll let you answer this one, and I'll let somebody else call in. And thank you very much, Mike.
Oh,
sure.
Thanks.
That's
exactly right. I think what you just said is exactly what's going to happen. Those of us that are in either in the higher vibrational state or have a propensity for vibration are going to be activated, and we are going to be the leaders and the teachers. And we can't just sit back and enjoy it. We have to participate.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I asked a friend of mine who is more than a little bit psychic, and I said, you know, I don't want to be the UFO guy all the time. You know, Ancient Aliens on the Moon, it's awesome. I love the show. I love the book. I love writing about this stuff, but God, you know, I'm always arguing with people. And there's people like the guy who called in that are always attacking me. I mean, literally, Brooks, if I post something on my blog, these people are attacking me within about an hour, you know, which is nuts. I mean, literally, really, you're so obsessed with me that you've got to watch everything that I put up for, you know, every hour. So it's like, I said to her, you know, I have these other talents. I mean, I've written other things. I've written novels. I've written screenplays. I've written other things that I know are real good. And I kind of would like to maybe be over there a little bit more and be able to just tell people what I want them, what messages I want to send them through fiction. So there's not so much argument and conflict all the time.
What she said to me was, hey, you know, what's going to happen is going to make a lot of people really uncomfortable. And those of us that are aware of what's happening and part of it are going to be have to be there to help those people through how uncomfortable they're going to be. So to answer the question is, yeah, we're all of us are changing, and we're all going to get what should be happening to her and what should be happening, Brooks, to you, and what has been happening to me is the people that you never guessed would care about this stuff will come out of the coming out of the woodwork and saying, you know, what do you know about 2012? Is that true? Has that been your experience?
Well, you know, all I do is double up on my placebos, and I'm fine. I've always, in all the interviews that I've done and books and stuff that I've written, I always try to stay on the scientific side of things, but I have to ask, you know, basically scientific questions. You know, when people say, oh, you don't believe in UFOs, do you? I have to say, well, can I answer the question with a question? You don't honestly believe we're alone in the universe, do you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you ask that question, then it's like, well, you know, and then you could just take it from there. You kind of defuse it. But I'm the Hollow Earth guy. I mean, come on.
Yeah, exactly.
I never said I believed in the Hollow Earth. I don't even claim that the Earth is hollow. All I'm saying is we have an expedition to go see if the Earth is hollow.
Or just hollow. Right, exactly.
Yeah, why not go explore? That's the thing. Anyway, it is a great genre, and it's exciting to be part of it. And I wouldn't trade the notoriety for anything. It gives you a base upon which to do things. And whether you or me sells a screenplay or gets it made into a movie and awakens people like Ayn Rand's recent book, although I think the production value is a little questionable. I don't think it was really ready for big screen. But it was all in all pretty well done. I think that we can affect the universe in a great way, and we can awaken people and excite them to being part of the evolution of mankind.
I agree with you, and you know, part of it is just, I mean, think about this. Ancient aliens on the moon. I mean, literally what I'm trying to do is just get people to look at pictures of the moon. I mean, just look at this stuff. I mean, literally, Brooks, I mean, here's a gigantic drill that you know, the tube of it runs for about 20 miles along this picture, and then it digs right into the side of a mountain, and there's all these cables holding it up. And above that is a bunker with a flying saucer in it with landing gear and instruments on it, and it couldn't be more obvious that that's what it is. And it's like, that's all I'm trying to do is just get people to look at and start with something like Ancient Aliens on the Moon, and just try to be willing to consider the alternate reality to the stuff that's been, you know, kind of shoved down our throats by the media for the last 100 years at least.
I think it's awesome, and I think all but one of our callers tonight do as well, and we don't want you to stop being a great explorer and a great spokesman.
Well, no, I'm not going to. I'm just saying there are times you wish that it would be, you know, there's times I wish I could just, there wouldn't be so much personal, negative, nasty stuff. The truth is, Brooks, like what you present about the Hollow Earth, what I present about ancient aliens on the moon, it's my truth. And people can choose to believe it or not believe it. Why somebody would be so, you know, upset with you or upset with me that they would accuse me of things falsely or attack me for no apparent reason, I don't really get. I don't get why, if they're so confident in their own reality, why can't they just live in it?
Well, whether people don't believe it or whether they do believe it, and we hope that they do, we want them to buy your book. It's Ancient Aliens on the Moon, and where can they get it?
Well, you can get it at most bookstores. It should be in. Are there any bookstores left besides Barnes and Noble? I think that's the only one left. You should be able to pick it up in the bookstore. You can get it from Adventures Unlimited Press, who is the publisher. That's David Hatcher Childress. You can pick it up directly from him. You can get it on Amazon.com. You can pick it up on Amazon Kindle. I think it's available on Nook, although I'm not 100% positive of that. And so one of the places to connect to all that is
to go to my blog, which is mikebarra.blogspot.com. That's just B-A-R-A, one R. And then you can also connect with me if you'd like on Facebook, although my Facebook personal page is loaded up with 5,000 members now or 5,000 friends. So I've got an author page, Mike Barra Author, on Facebook. You can connect with me on Twitter, and I'm MikeBarra33 on Twitter. And I've got a YouTube page, so just Google me. A lot of stuff comes up. A lot of it, don't believe it.
I can't believe there are 33 of you out there.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I really appreciate you coming on the program. Maybe we should talk sometime about doing an audio version of your book. I'd love to read it and record it.
Well, I'd love to have you read it too. But the question, you know, because you've got that great deep resonance actor radio kind of voice that I think everybody really loves, but then I might actually hear some of my words and say, dang, I wish I'd written that.
Yeah, I wish I'd never said that. Well, we'll do a special edited audio version that you have to.
Sounds great to me.
Listen, I hope you get over the conference crud and get back to 100% very soon.
I will very soon, I'm sure. And I hope to see you soon, especially next February.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, good. I'll drop you your own copy of Ancient Aliens on the Moon in the mail, and after you read it, we can talk about it some more if you want.
I'm excited about it. Thanks so much. Have a great week.
Okay, great. You too. Thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, that was the indomitable Mike Barra. I know he complains about getting a rash sometimes from people who are kind of irritating in this genre. And that's, you know, people, I guess, that are self-made commentators trying to criticize somebody who's done a great work when they haven't done any themselves. And you know how we feel about that here. We're all Earth explorers, and everybody's opinion is important, but it's so much nicer if you're well-informed. Speaking of well-informed, I want to, in this final half hour, by the way, the phone lines are still open, so if you didn't get your comment in, go ahead and give me a call. We'll talk about it a little bit. I have talked to you about silver from time to time, and I wanted to read you this really quick article about J.P. Morgan, because there are two aspects to silver you need to understand. One is the paper aspect, and the other is the actual hard metal itself. And I'm not talking about just silver coins. I'm talking about small silver bars. They're about an inch and a half wide and about 2 1/4 inches long, and they weigh 1 ounce, and they come in a little plastic sheath with a serial number on them, and it says 99.999% pure silver. And that's what I'm talking about, holding on to the real metal. Well, manipulation explained, or pure disinformation orchestrated to preemptively manage the fallout of the coming J.P. Morgan silver manipulation scandal. That's the big question. And when we're talking about scandal, we're talking with a capital S. As silver investors are likely aware, you may not be one, but I want you to be one in a very special way, and I'll explain that here at the end of the article. Leading silver analyst Ted Butler has openly speculated whether J.P. Morgan's alleged massive short silver position is held on behalf of a client such as the Federal Reserve with the intent to prop up the dollar by suppressing gold and silver, or the Chinese government with the intent of acquiring physical gold and silver bullion at a discount due to their massive paper short position on the futures market. Now, let me try to explain this to you. The document has long privately wondered whether the bullion banks, that's J.P. Morgan, their short positions could actually be leveraging with their own physical bullion accumulation by artificially suppressing the paper futures price. Now, here's how it goes. These thoughts originated, by the way, by Jim Sinclair. The industry insider has come forward claiming that J.P. Morgan's paper short position, that is to say, people have bought silver from them in the form of silver bullion by paper, is in fact a hedged trade, and claims that J.P. Morgan is in fact massively long physical gold and silver held in their own private vaults. That means, that is to say, they have the physical silver in their vaults, but they're selling paper against it and then shorting the paper futures market. JP Morgan might actually be a double agent, shorting the paper metals market for their own benefit. The claim is not only rational, but it also would perfectly explain why the CFTC has opened three separate investigations into silver market manipulation. This has been tried before. Clearly, if JP Morgan's commodities desk was accumulating mass physical gold and silver inventories in their own personal vaults, they would be able to claim their paper short position is a legitimate hedge. That's, in other words, they're betting on the price of silver and gold going down and thus making money if it goes down. And, of course, they make money if it goes up because they actually own the silver. You got it? That's what a hedge fund does. So when you hear somebody that they're a hedge fund, that's what they do. They bet that things will go down, and they put money up against it. Whereas Ted Butler focuses on J.P. Morgan and the big four commercial banks and their perpetual short position in silver, I don't recall him ever suggesting that they actually own the physical silver to offset their short positions. Normally, when a big company naked shorts a stock, they don't own the stock. They don't even borrow it from the company. Because they have a seat on the exchange, they sell the stock, telling the Securities and Exchange Commission that they actually have the stock when they don't. Now, they're going to get caught if that stock goes up. Because if that stock goes up in price, then they have to buy that stock and deliver it. But as long as the stock goes down in price, and hopefully all the way to zero and delists, not only do they not have to claim the money that they've been paid for the stock as income, but they never have to deliver the stock. It's free money. And all they're doing is ripping off the investor that buys the stock and owns the paper, which is worthless. But they're also ripping off the small company that they're shorting the stock for. Let's say a company has a market cap of $100 million, which is a pretty small company out there, a small business. And the market cap is basically based upon the price of their stock. But if JP Morgan Stanley or the market makers or some other broker gets a hold of that stock and starts, say, letting out some false bad news or, you know, pressuring Congress to pass a rule or a regulation that puts that stock in jeopardy, like a medical stock or a EPA ruling on some kind of fuel stock or something like that, it forces the stock to drop rapidly in value, which means that $100 million market cap company is now worth about 10 bucks. They have to lay off all their people. They have to close everything, liquidate everything, get rid of everything. And that bank, that JP Morgan or that market maker or that broker, they get to keep all the money. They never have to declare it. But this is different. In this case, JP Morgan may actually own the silver. Now, it's kind of strange that silver would be sitting around $38 an ounce when it is actually quite rare, because 90% of the silver that's been produced has been consumed. We use it in electronics and water filters and all kinds of medical applications. We use the silver, and also film industry, silver halide negatives. All that silver has been consumed over the years, so silver is actually pretty rare, maybe even more rare than gold, even though a lot more of it has been mined. So the interesting thing is that once the large companies that own, or large countries that own the paper, declare that they want to now own the bullion, they want to own the metal, they're going to go to the bank and they're going to say, okay, we own 27 million ounces of gold and we want it. We want it delivered. Put it on a pallet and deliver it. Well, the problem is that they might not own all that gold. They might not own all that silver. But once they start delivering it, their supply, their long position starts disappearing in a hurry. And when it does, so does their net worth. And what happens is this large bank, JP Morgan Stanley, now is caught in a scandal where the silver is not going to go to $40 an ounce. It's going to go to $400 an ounce. And if it does, it buries J.P. Morgan Stanley. They go out of business. Now, the question is, the government's already bailed them out one time, and they paid the money back, the TARP funds. What happens if these big banks who have been shorting silver, not all of them have, but most of them have, start going under? Are they too big to fail? Here's what he says. I worked for some of the largest bullion banks in the world over my career, and I ran all types of books and did a lot of business with central banks around the globe. I was involved in the largest gold hedge ever done in the history of the world back in 1996. This has been my life for the past 18 years. From 2000 to 2006, I was the gold trader at Barclays London. I have worked for AIG, Barclays, and UBS, some of the biggest bullion desks in the world. I worked for three of the major bullion banks for 11 years and was in charge of Barclays Gold Book and the hired 42 Brinks trucks to move our 27 million ounces of gold out of HSBC, that's China, vault, and into JP Morgan's vault when HSBC raised storage costs on us. I am 100% positive that it's there. I know we had 27 million ounces of gold on our daily balance sheet, and the other big banks all had around the same amounts. David R. left Barclays and moved to Manhattan to work for one of the largest and most successful privately held hedge funds in New York City. He was in charge of the precious metals trading department and supervised dozens of the most talented precious metals traders in New York. I was told by a reliable source that every metals trader worth his salt would kill to work for that firm. I hope that's not true. The traders were not salaried. They worked on commission only, and they all made big money. That is where I met David. He gave me a personal tour of their trading department. His understanding of the gold and silver industry and his resume is as good as it gets. The trader states that J.P. Morgan is indeed massively long physical precious metals and set to vastly benefit from the coming mania, precisely as Jim Sinclair had long predicted. You can too, by the way, in a smaller way. But they buy the physical silver at the same time they sell the future on COMEX. Futures trade in contango, higher price than spot physical, and they get zero interest rate, cash, from the Fed. So they borrow the money for free. So they own the vaults to store the silver. So as the future comes to maturity, they can either settle against their physical long or roll the future to collect more fee, contango. This is pure arbitrage, paid for by the Fed. This has been going on for over 30 years. And why wouldn't they be allowed to have 25% of the open interest? There's no manipulation because they are short the futures and long the physical and have zero price risk, but nice profits. It's brilliant trading and completely 100% legal. And that's why they will never be charged with manipulation, because there is none going on. Sometimes it's just that easy. David R. states there is no massive shortage of physical silver. It's just being hoarded by the bullion banks in their own private vaults ahead of dollar devaluation and collapse. Let's go and visit their vaults, and you can see all the physical silver there. Lease rates are at full carry plus. There is no shortage whatsoever, and the banks are charging 40 BP for storage because they cannot find any more space to put it all. I have some spare room here in my garage. You can take all the physical you want. The J.P. Morgan manipulation is not a manipulation, but a way of trading that has been going on for years. J.P. Morgan is short futures due to contango, and long physical. People need to understand that metals are just a derivative of the interest rate market, and once people do, they will get a better understanding why the market moves the way it does. I explained to you what HSBC and JP Morgan do on the silver. They get money from the Fed for free. They own all the storage vaults, so they do not have to pay the fees for storage. Then they own the physical silver in their vaults and sell the futures contracts at a much higher price. Since there's no cost for the money and no cost for storage, they make a fortune on the earnings. Miles Franklin's David Schechtman states he has known David R. for 4 years, that he is legitimate and the real deal, and that although David states J.P. Morgan's short silver positions are not naked, it is massively bullish for both metals, stating he is absolutely convinced that gold and silver are going much, much higher. He told me last week that with the Fed's latest open-ended quantitative easing edict, I told you about that earlier in the program, anywhere from $40 to $80 billion a month being printed and fed into the system by the Fed, just printed, nothing behind it. The dollar and the bond market are done, finished, and the bull market in gold is guaranteed. As far as he is concerned, Bernanke has sold out our kids and grandchildren, and it no longer makes any difference who occupies the White House. As mentioned previously, if J.P. Morgan is shorting gold and silver futures with the intent of eventually breaking the futures market, physical price linked to the metals, this would explain motive, pure profit, always the only motive for a bankster, as well as the reason why the CFTC has been unable to charge J.P. Morgan with manipulation of the silver market, even though they routinely fleece the specs using their algorithms and raids. While we have always believed the bullion banks will be long gold and silver when it really matters at the end of this massive secular bull, there are several points about trader David R.'s claims that bother us, this trader claims. J.P. Morgan is simply arbitraging futures versus physical using 0% cash from the Fed, but there have been single days, for instance, May 2nd of 2011, September 21st, I think it was for the starters, in which the COMEX volume, that's the actual paper bullion, the futures market, volume surpassed global mining output for the entire year. J.P. Morgan's physical holding cannot possibly equal their net paper short position, just on the COMEX, not to mention their over-the-counter positions. This trader also claims there is no shortage of physical metal. It is simply all being stored in J.P. Morgan's private vault, and he has seen the metal himself. Our thought is that he may have seen the metal, but that doesn't mean it hasn't been rehypothecated, and there are 1,000 people who believe they own it. That, in other words, that means they have reprinted the same title to the silver and given it out to multiple owners. It's sort of like having a Mercedes-Benz in your driveway and having someone else show up with the sheriff saying, "That's my Mercedes-Benz and I want it. I have the title right here and it's in my name." That's called rehypothecation. It means more than one person has the title to the same exact property. In this case, J.P. Morgan may have resold that silver 1,000 times. Finally, when this story was run by our friend Ned Taylor Leyland, he believes it is pure disinformation, stating that the story is a bit like the Blythe Masters interview and was orchestrated purely to preemptively manage the fallout of the coming J.P. Morgan silver manipulation scandal. I told you, it's a scandal with a capital S. How do you protect yourself? Well, there are two ways. One, of course, is to get your dollars, your disposable dollars, out of the bank. You got to leave your hard dollars in there because you got to cover things like your house payment and your internet payment and, you know, your cell phone bill and all that stuff you got to cover. You got to do that. You can't not pay your bills. But your disposable income, You need to start pulling it slowly out of the bank and stocking it in a shoebox somewhere in your house. The banks are not secure because when it closes, it takes your money with it, especially if your money is in a money market. If you have money market support to your checking account or money market support to your savings account or money market support in your 401k account, it's done. It's gone. The FDIC does not apply to that. You lose it. That's one of the risks you take. So pulling your money out, keeping it in your hands is one way to protect yourself. The other way is to take possession of physical metal. Now, I trust most of you people listening to this program can't just run out and buy $1,800, $1,900 an ounce gold and store it at your house. But silver is around $38 an ounce. Now, it's four times as high as it was 4 years ago, but it's nothing compared to what it's going to go to. I've showed you the experts. You can do your own research if you want. I don't make a dime off of this. I don't even list their link on my website. I buy my silver from APMEX, APMEX.com. Go there, check it out yourself, do some shopping, buy coins, whatever. I buy the little Engelhard 1 ounce bars. There's plenty of silver out there to be had now. And I would go ahead and make those purchases and get yourself in a good, safe position. The other thing that I implore you to do, and the time is getting short, Christmas is coming up. I am asking you to forego those expensive electronic games, all that stuff that you're going to buy for your older kids. I'm talking about the ones that have gotten out of college and have their own homes and all that. I would buy them food storage. I would go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the food investor, and order your loved ones, your family, the best gift of all. Some food security, so that when things stop rolling, and I don't know if it's going to be gas that stops or a solar flare or a cyber attack or whatever it's going to be, but I'm telling you, you can still go down to the grocery store and you can stock up on canned goods. You can do that if you want. It'll keep for a couple of years. It's a little heavy to lug around and not really in the right packaging, but you can do that. Or you can go to the food investor, and it's basically set it and forget it. This stuff will last for 30 years, no preservatives. It's good to go. Okay? That's my advice. Get a hold of my friend Scott Barzee and my other Danny Morris. They started the company The Food Investor out in Utah, and it's the best there is. We've spent a long time looking for the right source, and this is it. And I'm sharing it with you. So do that. All right, that segment is over with, and I appreciate your patience so much. Also, another nice thing to buy your kids is a Kindle or a Nook. Both of those are very cool. They're inexpensive, and it's a lot easier to carry around a Kindle and hundreds of books inside with color artwork and whatever, and even sound. Than it is to carry around a whole bunch of books and have a big library, which you got to haul around, which is also cutting down a whole bunch of trees. All of my books, the Ark of Millions of Years series, the Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, and my latest one, Alienated Nation, are all available on Kindle and Nook. And if you buy them from my website, you will get the audio version for free. So don't worry about it if you're not a good reader. I read it for you. By the way, I really want to appreciate the emails I got over the last couple of weeks. Very inspirational. I had no idea that X Squared Radio affects so many lives all around the world. It's a great, great treasure to me, and I appreciate it. Don't forget, November 10th, is the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. It's in Halversum, Holland. The link is at xsquaredradio.com. Amsterdam is as cheap to fly to as Miami, and you'll have a good time. So I would book your flight over there, get over there. It's going to be a great three-day conference. Teller's going to be there. Tiller agents are going to be there. John Searle engineers are going to be there. this is some of the best breakthrough energy on the planet. We have a couple of great presentations we're making over there. One is on the business of new energy. I remember one of our callers tonight, Robin, brought that up. And Mike Barra vehemently made his point that free, cheap energy dumped onto the economy would definitely rattle the windows, I'm telling you. But if you want to know what it's all about, you want to know what energy is coming, what's available, what prototypes are just on the threshold of being released to the world, that's the conference to go to. It's called the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. And I shudder to say, we probably couldn't even have this conference in this country. Not at this time. You want to go to it. You want to know what's coming up. You want to be in the right place at the right time. I would do that. Go to Amsterdam and check us out November 10th. Lots of great things coming up. I also want to let you know officially the Chichen Itza conference that we publicized here for about 9 months has been canceled as far as I'm concerned. We are not going to attend that. So if you're one of the thousands of people that clicked on that banner on my website to get to their website, I apologize. The economy is what it is, and it's hampered a lot of people. And we apologize for that. Sometimes these things happen. Perhaps they'll try again next year, although it's not going to be as exciting in 2013 as it is 2012, unless it's the conference of, hey, I told you so. So just interesting stuff going on. Keep those cards and letters coming. We're going to duck out of here in about 3 minutes. I just wanted to let you know, as you're preparing those Christmas presents this year, you've got a wide variety to choose from right here on X Squared Radio, and it's good anywhere in the world, okay? You can pick up those books, you can pick up the food, you can pick up the silver and have it delivered right to your house. No problem. Take care of you and yours. Appreciate the calls tonight and all the energy. It's been great. See you next week right here on X Squared Radio. We'll duck out and let our friends at Asheville Magazine play their trailer. Thank you so much. We'll see you next week.